I am the Lord of Darkness. I require the solace of shadows in the dark of the night. Sunshine is my destroyer. All shall change. Tonight, the sun sets forever. There shall never be another dawn on the podcast known as
Trapped Under Plastic, the podcast where the guests don't read the contract and end up paying for the fruit trays. And speaking of guests, we have a special one today, a manager of our local game store, collector of rocks, master of bits, and master of our hearts, Dan Molson.
Woo! Yeah, we got there. We got the Scott yell
right off the bat.
All right.
Also, now I feel like I was promised fruit trays.
No, but you're paying for them.
You were supposed to pick it up on the way here. Also, donuts. Where's the donuts, Dan?
Dude, that's one thing I miss about corporate America. Yeah. It was Donut Tuesday, man.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I could feel so fat eating a donut and drinking a soda at 8 a.m.
Yeah, but you were in your 20s at that point.
That's
like, it's a lot sadder when you're in like your 40s and you're Donut Tuesday and every one of those donuts just catches up to you.
Speaking of Donut Tuesday, where's my energy drink?
Ooh, how you doing, Dan?
Right here, buddy.
Oh, thank you.
I'm doing good. Speaking of desserts, we have a regular at the store that works at Crumble Cookie, and every once in a while on Wednesdays, because they're a comic subscriber, they'll have like batches that just get like messed up. Like one the other week was like mint chocolate chip cookies that were the wrong color chips.
Oh.
And so like literally we'll just like drop them off and just like, we can't sell these and we have to toss these.
Yeah. Take care of these for us, will you?
Yeah, that's dangerous.
Yeah, that sounds pretty dangerous. Let's get into the preamble ramble. Basically, you've listened to the podcast, right, Dan?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's just talk about bullshit.
Yeah.
All right, so actually, it's great that Dan's here because he was actually a part of this experience. We did that Star Wars RPG.
I'm ready to hear about it.
There were 7 encounters. I thought that we'd get through like 3. And it could be like, it'd be like a, you know, like a 2-session thing. And it still is a 2-session thing. But we got through 6 of them. Like, so
wow.
Some of them were really short. They were like, how do you climb up this mountain? Like, do you take the path? Do you scale the trees? Do you make some engineering rigging and like kind of scale like the side of the mountain? So they were kind of like shorter things to introduce the idea of like, well, how do you do a skill check? How do you do an opposed skill check when you're like versus another player? How do you do combat? And so each encounter explored like a new element, and some were simple, like the force checking one was pretty simple.
Yeah.
But other ones,
just a checkbox, yes or no.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, it was like there was like 3 kinds of ways you could use the force, and it was like you were all stuck in an ice pit, and it was like, how are you going to use your individual force skills to get out of the ice pit? And so some people would like force grab a rope down to them. Some would like fucking tap into the mind of like the local fauna to be like, get me out of this hole. And like, they would like help in some way.
Yeah.
I don't fucking know,
that,
dude.
That was mine. And I'm just like sitting there, I'm like,
what do I do?
Listening to the other 3 players, just like, yeah, I got force jump, I got force push. For
like, oh, that's pretty clear what you should do.
Force sense.
Yeah, I was reading the booklet. I was like, Dan, like, you're not going to think of this. No. Like, this is ridiculous.
My brain's just like, yeah, I sense I'm screwed. Well, okay, cool.
Good luck with your lives, guys.
3 days and 5 hours. Cool.
The experience, though, was pretty good. Like, it felt really easy to be a DM in that situation because a lot of it was so hand-holdy. Mm-hmm. But the system was interesting in how you could, like, have a player succeed but with a demerit or fail but with, like, a positive. So, like, there was a spectrum of success and failure you could experience as a player. I didn't feel like my lack of Star Wars deep knowledge really ever was too much of an issue.
Not at all.
How was playing it?
It was really fun. You're really good also with, there's a lot of things that like people were thinking up that weren't really necessarily outlined, like the dual blasters.
Yeah.
Like not having rules for someone with dual blasters, and like I went full D&D and the first time we like took out some bad guys, I'm just like, yeah, I got fists for melee weapons. I'm going to, that guy got a knife better than my hands. And yeah, one of the players took a blaster pistol off of one of them. So it was like trying to figure out like, can you dual wield in this game? And like the structure of that game with like that starter box didn't have that. But Scott was like, okay, yeah, you can dual wield. But like here's kind of some detriments to the fact that, you know, you're trying to use 2 pistols
right.
in one action. Yeah. And like it worked really well. Like it wasn't just like, oh yeah, no, you're going guns blazing, no detriments, you're going ham, it's full
gotta
Rambo.
Be some,
it was
some issues,
like,
right?
Yeah, yeah, and it was, you did a really good job of kind of like mitigating where the rules had their limitations and where the players kind of were trying to brainstorm stuff and like kind of finding the way to make that mesh.
Well, I didn't expect to get praised so much, but I appreciate it. One thing made me think of you a little bit, or just like a typical DM problem, was one of the players had a very good ability to charm or be very charismatic to people. Mm-hmm. And so he walked up to a guard and was like, he basically asked, can you let us pass this bridge? And he used the relevant skill check and he passed it with ease and he walked past the guards. And I was like, he's going to do this exact same thing to the other guards on the other side of the bridge. And he fucking did it. And so on the spot, I made up like a different rule for these guards. Like they were like the more veteran primary ones that were like less susceptible to like being convinced. And so I gave him like another like difficulty die and he failed the check. And so he had to do something different. But I bet like players will try to abuse whatever system you have in place and you have to kind of like change the environment. So like they have to think about different solutions. You ever experience that?
Yeah, that's a big thing. It's like I always say, if players do something that it seems really powerful or like, oh man, they're really set up to be amazing at this at all times, and then it's just the one tool they use for every situation, I will let them have those moments to shine, but I will be very cognizant of when they are abusing it.
Yeah, okay.
And it's like, I'm not going to let you abuse it, but... And that's usually a conversation you can have, you know, outside of the game world, too, and be like, that's awesome. I want to make sure you play the game with the character you built, but I also want you to not be lazy. Yeah. You know, I want you to think of creative ways. And there's one way that you can kind of do both is, like, you can let them roll that all the time and be fairly successful with it, but you can say, hey, I want you to role play what you're saying to this guy. What would appeal to him? You tell me. You talk as your character. And then if you're like, well, this is, looks like he's a, you know, it looks like he's a young guard. He's kind of looking to the other guard a lot. Like he doesn't really know what he's doing. He's kind of fumbling his rifle or whatever. And it's like the conversation you approach with him should be different than the approach with the veteran kind of scowling at you, unsure of you guard.
Sure.
And if they're willing to put in that effort of role-playing their character based on the scenario, then I'm like, then fuck yeah. Yeah, you can roll your good check all you want because you put in the work. That's basically it.
Okay. That makes sense. Make them work for it a little bit.
Yeah. As long as they're willing to put in the work, I want them to succeed at the thing that excited them about the character.
Yeah. It was fun. Oh, and one last thing I did. You were supposed to read out a title crawl for the beginning of the scenario because like that's how you explain like what the story is and what you're working toward, and it's like a classic Star Wars thing, but they have it printed on the back of a box. And so because I have some slight video editing skills, I went and made the title crawl in Premiere Pro, and then we watched it at the beginning of the session with like the music and like the Star Wars
title. Scrolled slowly.
Scrolls away, you know. Awesome. It took like 30 minutes to do, so it wasn't too hard, but that was fun to start that way.
That's something that you could so easily do every session.
I know. It's once you figure out like the format, especially, you just drop in the font and then it's easy.
Drag and drop the text in.
I honestly thought until you said that you made that, I thought that was something that like FFG put out just because it's like,
thank you.
It's a starter box set. Okay.
Why wouldn't you
give you those extra things? Yeah. The longer those things exist, like all the D&D ones, the longer those exist, the more extra things people will create for them or like homebrew for them, or the more things the company will put out. Like, oh, like for the one we were playing, it was very happenstance that everyone just liked all four of the characters.
Yes, that was lucky.
Picked a different one as well.
Yeah.
But like the fact that they had two other characters for people to play if like a GM was running it multiple times, that kind of stuff. Like,
yeah.
More time that something like that is out, the more of that stuff kind of comes out for it.
That's true.
So like I was just like, oh yeah, he must have found this like someone. And when you're just like, yeah, I made this, I was just like, oh, that's great.
I'll have a link in the description in case anyone else wants to use it for if they play the Beginner Force and Destiny box, because that'd be great if someone else used it other than me one time.
There's part of that return on investment for your time of how much use you get out of it.
Yeah.
Like, look, I like the four of you a lot. You're cool guys and everything. But y'all need to share this with your families at home and shit.
You need to tell me I'm cool. Yeah. So that was us. That was the preamble ramble. What you got, John?
Oh,
that was it. We're done with that. No, okay. Yeah, what do you got, John? You got ducks.
Yeah, I got ducks, dude. The whole world, it just comes down to ducks. You know, Like sometimes you see a
duck. Wait. Is this going anywhere real?
No, I just want to bring back ducks. I want to bring back ducks.
He's ducking out on the real question.
Oh, yes. Nice.
Yeah, I got him. Yeah. So ducks.
Duck off, bro.
I want to talk about priming for a quick second. With okay. You gentlemen. I've kind of come full circle and I'm ready to try back to the beginnings endeavor of, I think airbrush priming is bullshit.
Yeah.
I fucking hate it. It's so bad. It's so
you're dumb.
Inconsistent. The product is not made for miniatures. This polyurethane crap that is like, you can keep every setting the exact same and you'll use the exact same variables every time. And it is so inconsistent.
In what way?
The product of polyurethane airbrush primer has a half-life. It will try to bind to itself while it's in suspension in that bottle.
What the fuck does that mean?
It means
Mr.
that...
Mr. Science Man.
It means that, in theory, you have about half of a bottle of polyurethane primer before you are playing with fire, and it's going to fuck.
Buy less.
I'm not buying a giant bottle.
Buy less. I'm saying the opposite.
Have you tried straining it too? I know a couple people where they, and like Green Stuff World, I think even makes like, so they probably got it from someone else, but someone makes little strainers that fit in the cup of airbrushes. My guess is probably for this exact reason.
It probably is.
Because, I know at least one person that years ago was doing this.
It globs up. Yeah. It goops up. It's like it creates speckles and all that dusting and stuff because it's trying to adhere to itself. It's like even if you put it on the Vortex mixer for a long time, every time I've had. Why this has got me so riled up is because I found spots on the things that I cared the most about. I took every single precaution. I double checked everything I did. And I have texture on that I had to burnish off of my Golden Demon models. Like, this should not be it. And it's not a brand thing. They all do it. Some are better or worse than others. But it's the product itself. I'm going back to fucking rattle cans, baby.
Okay, I don't think rattle cans are going to be, like, any better with detail retention. Like, they will apply more paint to the surface. They probably will be stronger for that. But I must have gotten lucky or something. I've had the exact same 16-ounce bottle of Steinelrez for 3 years, and I prime with it, and I feel like I don't have any issues.
I'm just real bad at using my airbrush, so I switched to Rattle Can when I tried the Vallejo
Nothing wrong with Rattle Can. Yeah. I have no problems with Rattle Can. I use it because it's easy sometimes and it's fast. I don't think it's better than an airbrush primer.
Like, well, that, and I heard like a lot of the European and British dudes that even heavy, heavy airbrushing people over there. Only rattle can. They're priming.
Why? Did you ask them why?
I talked to a little Andy Wardle about it. And he's like, and little Andy, obviously, one of the world's greatest painters, an amazing airbrusher. And he's like, yeah, dude, don't fuck with airbrush primer. He's like, it's Russian roulette. Like, you will, and when it fucks up, you're like, fuck, now I have to spend how many days of work of stripping, of cleaning, of whatever. And I'm not, like, there's other variables involved in a rattle can that I have also personally experienced, mostly when I'm trying to use, like, Rust-Oleum and shit, where it's like, uh-oh, you can screw that up, too. But I'm just like, that stuff is, like, once that's on there, it's not going to rub off. Yeah. Rattle can primer is not going to peel off from your hands. Have you ever had it where you prime a model and it gets around the base rim of the base? I usually try to prime all that anyway, so then the black base rim paint job will adhere better. That peels up like it's peeling off like Elmer's glue off your fingers when you're a kid. If you get one little spot, it'll peel off. It's like a whole section. And so the same thing will work around your model. If you rub one area, it'll peel. And so you'll get like this banana peeling on your models if you rub off some of that airbrush primer.
That has not happened with me.
Yeah.
I'll hit corners sometimes and like the gray will expose, but it very clearly tapers to the actual level of the primer. Like there's no like lip that I can like raise up and get a tool under or anything. Mm. I don't know.
It reminds me back in the day when I first started painting and I, for some reason, this really stuck with me. It was one of the early Painting Buddha videos. Mm. I think it was the corn, Lord, where he has got the doggy, where Ben Collins is painting it. And at the beginning of the video, he's showing it, and he rattle-cannon primed it, apparently.
He did all of them smart that way.
You could see gray. And even that, it was like 480p, maybe 720 video. Like, you could see gray on it. And he addressed it. He's like, the point is not that you get every single tiny little dot in detail. You're just trying to create a surface to adhere to. And if you don't get everything 100% covered, that's not the point of primer.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, ah, oh, I got to remind myself of that. Because we like to prime things in like a pure glossy black or pure matte black. And it's just like, oh, it looks so good already before. And it goes back to my dumbass brain thinking that every step of a paint job, when I finish that step, it needs to look good for the final product to look good. And that's not how painting works.
But you just need that tooth to grip onto, right?
Yeah, that's all you're doing. So I will report back. I got some Army Painters primer coming. And then I wanted to find just some regular ass Chaos Black. I actually worked with a company. I want to shout them out because the owner is just a really fucking nice dude. Because I'd heard really good things about them, and they going to send me. They make a bunch of different really nice primers, and shit, I can't see if I can find him.
I know the GW primer. I had my last bad experience with primer was I got some of those Sector Imperialis bases, and since I use contrast and like contrast like stuff, I was going to do a base of each contrast color and make like a little display for customers to look at. And I went to use the Gracier primer and just spraying it, it smelled really like oily mechanical.
Mm.
And like, I don't know if I just got like a bad can, but it smelled terrible, smelled awful. And then there is like probably a good like 20% of the bases that had like weird like crackling.
Yeah, there's a whole other chemical thing. Really yeah, you gotta bad. Shake the yeah. shit out of those.
Yeah,
Color Forge.
I've never had them smell weird.
Yeah, it smelled real funky.
Yeah, it's not good. Color Forge is the name of the company.
Okay,
they're a UK company, and the guys were really nice. Emailed me back, and their website's really impressive. And I heard that they're really good primers. And he's like, yep, I'll send you over a wide variety. You can try them all out. You know, that's cool. And he's like, can you just give me your address stuff? He's like, oh, shoot, you're in the USA. Because it's rattle cans.
Oh,
and they're
yeah,
in the UK,
yeah.
and they don't have a distributor for the North America yet. And he's like, oh, dude. He's like, and he was really apologetic. He felt bad. I'm like, man, don't feel bad. Like, I feel you. Don't stress out. I'm like, he's like, we're in the process. We're trying to set it up. I'm like, you let me know as soon as you do. But
shipping flammable stuff like that is weird.
Yeah. So it's like, I don't know how some of the companies, you know, do it. They must have to do it in bulk and then go through distribution here, like Army Painter and GW, to do that. But like when they came out with a new spray, like when Contrast 2.0 came out, I think that's when it was, they came out with a new version of the Corax White rattle can spray, just their regular white. And they're like, you know, it's new, it's better, it's whatever. And I got a can of that when I was over there and tried it there, and it was so freaking good.
Yeah.
It's so smooth now, and it was so easy to apply, and I felt like they got the nice big fat caps on them now. You just feel like you have so much more control. Those little, remember the old tiny little skinny caps?
Little red skinny caps.
Like, yeah. I just feel like...
The big white ones are nice.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm trying to, like, thread a needle with a shotgun with those things. You're just like, just want to spritz, which is like, oh, fuck me.
Yeah.
So
honestly, yeah. GW, even their old white primer, when people needed a white primer... Like people would always recommend that one, and I used it, and honestly, it was great. It was like one of the better white primers that I used if I wanted to do like Xanthal undercoating with rattle cans.
Mm-hmm.
So they kind of always been killing it with that. I know white primer is harder to prime than like black stuff, but if you get it right, then it worked pretty well.
Yeah. Have you used Vallejo yet at all? Their rattle can?
That's
all I pretty much use now.
I haven't, but if we go to the source today, if you have a can of black of that, I'm going to buy it. Because I know like Squidmar and Lucas, they use that and they really speak highly of it, their new Vallejo primer in the can.
Yeah, that's the one downside to them is stock levels are really hard with Vallejo in general sometimes. And the primer, like I'm holding my breath for the primer, like white primer to come back in. But like they give you two different caps. They give you a skinny cap and a large cap. But they're both those bigger format caps, but it's just the nozzle. They have a wider nozzle and a thinner nozzle. But their stuff dries with like a really, it's not quite like a satin finish, but almost. So like for me doing mostly contrast, I'll do like a gray all over and then a white top down, because I don't go all the way to black, and just super, super easy, super smooth. And honestly, I've had better luck with that not getting funky for like blending together than I did with airbrushing.
Yeah. Reminds me, the other thing that I heard and I can attest to myself is that like, whatever the percentage is, but a vast majority of the issues that you have with your airbrush come from priming.
See, okay, that is the one thing that I would definitely agree with. It's like, it's kind of like doing fatty base coats with your super nice brush. It's like, just use a shitty brush and then keep the layering for the nice brush. So it's like, you don't want to gunk up your airbrush with primer and shit. So just like, keep just acrylic paint.
Yeah, it
totally.
Especially, yeah, because it is gunkier. And even if it's like, that's not when you had your problem, like, 3 days later or a month later, you're airbrushing, like you're doing an airbrush glaze of like a yellow over your highlights to try to make it all a little bit warmer, and then it starts to spit or gets clogged up. The reason that happened was a month ago when you primed with it.
Yeah.
This is when you're seeing it. And it's just, I find like I have my brushes, my hard-earned Steenbecks that I don't prime with.
Yeah.
I've never had so much as an inkling of an issue with any of those brushes. And I'm like, gosh, man, are these just like so much better than Iwata, my HPCS? And I'm like, no, I just prime with that one. That's why I have more issues with it.
Yeah, same thing. I use my Evolution for priming and my HPBS for all the acrylic detail work now, because I've had a lot of airbrushing issues. I'm trying to figure them out. And I want to talk about that actually in the after party segment. We're talking about what we experimented with. I think I've kind of discovered something about the airbrush, and I'm excited to tell you about.
Oh man, oh.
Kind of. I don't know.
That's a good spoiler.
More testing required.
That's a good spoiler to for those of you that want to support the podcast and join us over on Patreon. There's a link down in the show notes, the video description of our Patreon, and one of the big benefits you get in addition to making sure that we can pay the high retention fees of guests like Dan
and the fruit trays he requires,
and many fruit trays. Dragon fruits,
dude,
kiwis.
Dude, you give me a fruit tray, I will destroy it.
I'll go anywhere.
You do get some nice perks, the main one being an extended version of the podcast, which is about 30 to 45 minutes of extra content. Every single podcast available only to our patrons, both in video and audio format. And whichever way you like to consume the Trapped Under Plastic podcast, you can do that at your leisure. There's a lot more nudity and swearing. It's more of an NC-17.
Yeah, we take our shirts off right when it starts.
Yeah.
Trapped Under Plastic after dark.
All right. I got my second game of Necromunda in. Also, Dan is involved in this. He's the perfect guest. I was against House Escher, and good old Jetty D fucking slew some more people.
He still can't be killed?
He's a problem, bro.
We need to make like a wanted poster. Once you finish painting that model fully, one of us is just going to sneak a photo in one of the games and then just put a wanted poster in. It's just going to be a bounty. Just everyone's going to ante up credits, and it's just going to be a bounty for your
stupid
leader.
That would be an awesome sub game.
No, I don't like this idea.
Betting with your in-game currency.
Oh, that's fucking sick, actually. That's sick. But you know, he clapped Death Maiden. He also destroyed the leader of Dano's gang and a third person. I actually used one of my guys as bait, and he took the bait with his Death Maiden, and he ran up and killed that one guy, and then I came out and just severed him to death. Because he has this rule where in Necromunda, whenever you go down to zero wounds, you have to make an injury roll. You might get a flesh wound, which is not that bad. It reduces your toughness by one. You might get a serious injury, so you're on your back, or you might be out of the game. But out of the game is like the 1 in 6 chance. So okay. It's actually kind of hard to fully kill someone. You can really incapacitate them. But Jetty D has this rule where whenever he reduces a character to 0, they just die.
Oh, shit.
It's called Sever because he has a greatsword. And so he's just killing everybody. And I feel so bad. But he's a ninja, man. He smoke grenades and he runs in and kills someone.
At least they're not like dead.
No.
But
they go to the doctor.
Out of the game immediately. Yeah. You roll on the injury chart. Yeah.
Love
which
it.
Which could be dead.
Could be dead.
Yikes. Yeah. Oh, so he's like, he actually can insta kill.
Like the goons, you can insta kill the goons, but like the leaders, all of them have 2 healths. The big brutes probably have like 3 or 4. Well, we haven't seen any brutes yet, really.
Not yet.
Yeah.
Evan had me order him the one Forge World model. That's like the big mech suit exo driller or whatever it's called for his his squats, and I'm like, oh god.
Yeah, yeah, but Jetty's a fucking problem, and I love it. He actually accumulated so much experience that I could buy a secondary skill from my tree, which is like 12 experience.
Oh Jesus!
Because when you kill a leader, it's 3 just for that.
Yeah.
And so I got Nerves of Steel. So now whenever I get shot at. Whenever you get hit, like when you roll the hit and you get shot with a ranged weapon, not if it even wounds, you get pinned in the game. And so when I get shot at with Jetty D, I have Nerves of Steel, so I can make a cool check and then I might not get pinned. And he has pretty good cool. So,
what does pinned mean?
Means you hit lay down. Oh. And you have to spend a whole action standing up.
Back up.
And charging is 2 actions. So you'll never be able to stand up and charge, which is his thing. He needs to be able to charge.
He needs to get in there.
So if I can pass my cool check, then I don't get pinned, then I can just fucking...
Bro, he's totally just the action hero.
He's a tank,
like,
dude.
The bullets are flying, and he's the one guy that's just standing there still walking, like not jumping for cover.
He's got a fucking sword in the 41st millennia, dude.
Yeah, I love it. Doesn't make any sense.
Anyways, I'm loving Necromunda.
It's Gundam.
Probably because I'm winning, obviously. That's why I'm loving it.
It's just Gundam. You have all the technology to make these world-shattering robots, and what do you arm them with? A giant fucking sword. Like, now what are you doing?
What are you doing?
Dude, but laser swords, bro.
Dude, laser cannon from a mile and a half away and just shoots and kills your Gundam as you fall. He's like, but I had a sword!
What the fuck? Where's the honor?
Yeah. Oh, God, you guys are talking about Necromunda. I want to hear Dan's take on Necromunda, but before we do that, I spent an evening this last week looking through all the factions in the model of Necromunda.
Yes.
Going down that rabbit.
I was like,
yes!
And there's all that, and I could have found out the answer myself to this question that I'm about to pose you to, but I was lazy, and I thought this was content. So there's a whole section of models that are like, I don't know if they're called... if they're labeled as like mercenaries or like free dudes, does that mean that any faction can take them, or does that mean like they are their own faction? There's so many.
So they're like bounty hunters or hangers-on and stuff. Certain ones will be like specific to their faction. It's like, hey, everybody that's playing this gang can hire them potentially.
Okay.
Because I know Evan has his one hangers-on that's for his faction. Some of them can go out of faction, but then there's also... I haven't looked into it too much because I'm like, I just keep not rolling enough credits to get anything.
They're
like,
expensive.
I keep trying to get a shotgun, and I keep being like five credits short of a stupid shotgun.
I just need a shotgun.
I just want a shotgun for my guys with bad ballistic skill and just template.
You gotta just like,
you don't get to aim anymore.
Pawn off your watch.
Yeah.
So you can get that extra 5 credits.
You can kind of do that. Yeah.
I'm good for it.
He killed a guy because he basically caught one and killed one. And I
ransomed.
I literally sold all the guy's gear, and I was still like 10 credits shy.
Oh,
John, we were using a house rule where you can sell for half credit.
Okay.
People's gear and stuff like that, and it was like 10 shy.
No.
But, yeah, all those bounty hunters. A lot of them are just like any faction. Some will have limitations, like your gang has to be law abiding, or your gang has to not be. Like, I think you
outlaw.
Have, like, what is it, like the road preacher or something?
Hive
like that.
Preacher, yeah.
Yeah.
So there are some hangers on that are like cheaper for you to hire and more expensive for other houses to hire. So there's the whole spectrum, ones that are unique to your faction, ones that are available to everyone for the same cost, and everything in between, I think.
Okay.
They're cool, though. The models are fucking awesome.
I know. There's so many there that I just realized that, like, I'm just a sucker for, like, one-offs, things that look slightly different than, you know, because a lot of the gangs, they're a lot of samey-same. And so I'm like, okay, I got to put on a...
Really? You think they're the same?
Yeah. No, they don't look similar to each other.
Oh, the ones within.
Yeah, within, they often look, you know, too samey-same.
Sure.
But... also, that's where it comes in a bunch of the fun with kit bashing and stuff. And it's like, yeah, okay, I got to not look at it just through this, you know, new player lens of what they look like on the box art. I got to, you know, imagine it myself. So I didn't, none of them immediately stood out to me.
Okay.
Their factions. I did like the corn looking dudes with the devil helms.
Oh, what is
Corpse
that?
Grinder cult.
Cult, dude. Yeah.
Like, that's
their name is so fucking sick.
I know. I was like, man, these guys look badass. Although they look like they're running up and murdering stuff, which would be fun. But I feel like I'm gonna get a shot to shit.
Dude, so, smoke grenades.
Supposedly, like when I was reading, like what were like as much as Necromunda doesn't really have meta things, like what things certain organizers and stuff are kind of like pushing people away from, which kind of tells you it's like, oh, that might have some ways to break it, because the game does have ways to break it. Apparently, like Corpse Grinder, Vansar are like two of the ones that people are just like, you can do some shenanigans, because apparently—
Why are you telling John this?
They're—
Oh, yeah. Well, well.
Yeah, yeah. This will end very well. What are you talking about? But yeah, apparently they just have like super long ranges for their stuff, and they have, I think they have something that's like a mask where like they're harder to shoot if you're shooting them while they're like on like a charge in. Because like I have a lot of stuff where it's like, I have Palinite drills, so it's like my Judge Dredd space cops have drills for things that they do, and one of them is like you get to interrupt someone charging in with someone else. So like, say you charge like cop A, cop B just sits there, racks the slide of a shotgun, and just unloads on you as you go in.
You have the right to remain silent.
It's called, like, On Your Six, I think is the name of that one. Or like one of them is like On Your Six, where it's like you basically get to like Overwatch. So like I think they have some stuff that prevents some of that.
I just watched Carl Urban's Dredd like 2 weeks ago for the first time for real.
Oh, really?
And it was incredible.
I rewatch that like once every like three. I love Carl Urban as an actor to begin with. Like him in The Boys is also really good. Yeah, but like him as Judge Dredd is like, I'm like, I want more of this. Yeah. So bad.
I've never
so
seen bad. That. I need to watch.
It's really, it's good. It's really good.
Okay. It's cheesy, but it's good. It's like cheesy where Judge Dredd should be cheesy, but it's also real, real good. Just
okay.
Beat him up.
I'll put it on my list. Speaking of cheesy, maybe we can watch it one night late at Adepticon.
I'd love to. Okay. I love watching movies.
Okay. Speaking of cheesy, did either of you gather what the quote was from that?
Oh, can you say like the first like 7 words? I feel like I recognize the beginning.
Yeah. I am the Lord of Darkness. I require the solace of the shadows and the dark of night.
This sounds like a Lord Dracula thing.
It's not.
Okay.
It's not. It is the probably the single best practical effects ever done in movies.
The thing
is this guy.
Oh. Oh, he is like the character. Oh, God. It's legend, dude.
Yeah, baby.
Yeah. Woo! Yeah. That movie fucking rules.
Dude, it's on. Hey, for all, I've been shouting the praises of free YouTube movies. The YouTube movies channel. You go under the free with ad section. And they bring out new movies like every week, and Legend was on this week, so I'm sitting there painting, and I'm like, oh, I get to watch Legend. Yes.
That's dangerous for me to know. So I've never actually seen that movie. I've seen so much stuff around it. I've seen so much of the pop culture stuff. So like I know a bunch of stuff that it's about, but like
I've never seen it, and now
I need to watch it.
It's a visual trip too. Yeah.
It is.
It's crazy.
It's so good. I know you will love it, Dan, because it is the kinds of things that you enjoy. So you just sit down and watch young Tom Cruise before he went batshit crazy. Yeah. And
Tim Curry
as Lord of Darkness. And what is this? It's just Darkness? Yeah, Darkness is
Satan.
His name. Yeah.
Also, the one girl who's in it is the same girl from Ferris Bueller's Day Off. She's Sloan, whatever her name is.
Yeah.
I can't remember the actress's name.
I can't either.
If you want to watch it with me, I would love to watch it with you.
Yeah, hell yeah. So we just got a coworker just brought in. He has a bunch of statues, and he collects a lot of statues, and he brought in Tim Curry's character as this big statue. Partially, the only reason he wants to get rid of it is just the fact that the chair is so huge.
Oh, you have it at the store right now?
Yeah.
I have to go look at that later.
Yeah. I'll be a bad influence. It's fine.
I got some shelf space now. Yeah. Put up LED lights above all my cabinets, and I need some cool things to be shining from that funky light.
Hell yeah, dude.
Okay, yeah, so we got there. I did have a question with both of you about spider porn. Are you guys still playing spider porn?
We have not played any more spider porn, but new things have come out that are exciting that I want to try out. But the problem with AMG, and this is actually the reason why I made that comment about GW in our Facebook chat yesterday, AMG will tease a character, and then 2 months later, the rules for the character will come out. And then 3 months later, the model will come out. And it's just like the fucking runway for that company to get a product out is so goddamn long. But it's like, you can't blame them. Like, I can't imagine how difficult it is to manage that MCP, Star Wars Legion, Star Wars Armada with like their team of like, what, 20 people max?
Jeez.
Right? Like, they have so many properties they have to work on, and it feels like they're, you know, fucking Bilbo and Fellowship of the Ring, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
bread, bro.
Yeah.
And butter. it's an issue. Like, I don't know. This is outside looking in. I'm totally guessing, but it's annoying.
How long into that response, Dan, did you understand what spider porn was referring to?
It took me a moment. It was when he said like AMG, and I'm like, oh, Shatterpoint. Yeah. Okay, we got there.
Yeah, because in the last episode, he just had SP down. He's talking about SP. I was like, what's SP? What, SP? SP, what's that, spider porn?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the joke. So every time you say that, it's not, the name of the game isn't called Shatterpoint anymore.
Not no more.
John's doing a John thing.
Yeah. Ghost Boat.
Yeah, so now you have to...
Ghost Boat, goddamn.
2.0.
Check out your...
Spider porn.
Yeah, go get your copy of Ghost Boat, wherever Ghost Boats are sold. it's you play as little spiders, a variety of spiders, really, in precarious situations and revealing clothing.
Yeah. We're getting the SP lore.
Yeah, this is the true lore of that game.
Yes.
So, you know, if you want to make your droids all into spiders from now on, Dan,
yeah,
I'm just saying it's
spider droids. It sounds like Necrons.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm just imagining the scene with Grievous when he crawls on all fours, he runs away from Obi-Wan.
That's a Star Wars thing.
Yeah, that works, right?
It works, yeah.
It's in the lore. I'm just me.
Yeah. You have wet pellets in here as well?
Oh, yeah. I've been working with Game Envy. I'm going to show you this.
I was going to say that launched, right?
Yeah.
This is a prototype, and the actual color is a deep crimson. I had to like pick off of the whatever official color palette stuff. I did deep some color tests. And this was just the one he sent me that they had on file to check with the logo and everything. But yeah, I have a wet palette partnered with Game Envy. It's the wet palette that, since I started using it about a year ago, is just my favorite wet palette in the world. I know Vincy uses it. I think Scott uses one. I don't know if you've got one, Dan.
I've been waiting to since... So Britt got one at Adepticon last year, and I keep being lazy and waiting because I technically own a couple of wet palettes that I don't use like a heathen, but I love the little drywall palette at the top there too.
Yeah, you can get all that stuff in one fell swoop and put all your brushes in and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, so really cool to work with them. It's nice. It's a small company working with Kit, the owner, and just kind of having fun together, and it's nice to support a small US-based company in a product that I use all the damn time and really enjoy. So I'm like, hey, yeah, let's work together and let's do this. So there's a Kickstarter out right now. If you just search Exemplar Wet Palette, you'll find it, and then you can support them, and I get a little bit of a kickback too, which is, you know, you support just John, not Scott.
Yeah. I'm really excited for the lamps that they have, those like Lucent lamps or whatever,
good,
where it's the two arms. Did you?
Yeah, I got one of those. I got one of those. And actually at Nova, I got to try it out, and that's where he's like, oh yeah, I'll get you one. And I use mine in my airbrush station now, because I have my little airbrush section off to the side, and it's two separate lights, and you can kind of angle them and have them pushed down right over my airbrush area. Super slick, but yeah, I cleaned it under them for regular painting too, and it's just great. So that's it. That's all the shilling I got for today.
I use a Masterson palette at the office, and at home I use a plastic plate.
Yeah, I was going to say, I have a Masterson palette that I got from a coworker when he stopped painting. And he also had like an Army Painter one that's like this big.
Yeah, the teeny tiny ones. I remember those.
I have and keep sitting there and keep like using it as a storage box instead of actually using it as a wet palette.
You just keep rocks in there?
Yeah.
I used Kit's wet palette one time at home. And then I didn't paint a lot back in the day. And so I like forgot about it. And then the sponges grew black mold. And now I'm just like scared to use it. Like, I don't know what like safety precautions I need to take to like make it safe for me to like lick my brush.
I didn't use theirs back when they had their old sponges. They came out with, just in the last year, I think, their brand new sponges, which is a dual sponge. It's got the standard like top half of it's gray. The bottom half of it is that black, more porous sponge. It's kind of like in the clamshells.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you put that side down and that brings more of the moisture in. And then it acts like it fills up the top part of the sponge.
Oh, interesting.
And I have not
sponge tech.
Yeah. And so that's part of the reason why I like that better, is like over a long painting session, especially if you have all your heavy lights on there, the center of your palette can kind of end up being an island, even if you're squeezing in more water from the sides as you paint. Theirs seems to hold it more consistently and not get dried out and get that peeling. So once that peeling starts on your paper on a corner, you're fucked.
Yeah, you can't. You can stem the bleeding a little bit.
You can stop it, but you can't. Like, you know, you're not going into surgery there. Yeah, you're just putting a Band-Aid on that.
Dude, okay. It's interesting you mentioned this thing about sponges and being able to transfer liquid faster. I feel like whenever I use a palette where it's like a plastic plate and you're using like paper towel as the sponge.
Yep.
I always feel like whenever I do that, my paint gets so watery so fast.
Yeah.
Too much.
It's letting too much.
It's so interesting. I really want to know what the science of what's going on there, because it's definitely different when I use like the Swedish sponge that you see in matches and palettes and probably out with most things. So that's interesting. I'm going to look into that.
Yeah, it's definitely a thing. Sometimes you can use that to your advantage. I actually think that old Army Painter one that you have, Dan, did that for me too. And I'm like, okay, this is the palette I should use if I'm just gonna do a bunch of like glazing and shit. It's like you don't have to add any water, and it's like, oh, this is a perfect heavy glaze consistency no matter what kind of paint I put on it.
Interesting.
But if you wanted to do layers at that, fuck that. That's gonna be tough.
Let's get into what we painted. Dan, why don't you get us started here? What have you been working on lately in the hobby?
Why I asked you about if you have extra magnets is I just magnetized like all my city's army.
Nice.
It was so many models.
Yeah, I mean, yes, a lot of bodies.
So, like, the last two nights have been finishing up magnetizing all of that, okay. And then primed all my Ewoks, the little tiny teddy bears, murder teddy bears.
Yeah. Dude, they do not like spiders. Spider hunters.
Yeah, exactly. I used a bunch of the basing bits from John and had fun just being super creative, building up those bases and had fun with that, and then just intermixing all of that, like magnetizing, assembly, priming, and then my Necromunda warband in addition.
Yeah, you painted one of your cops, right?
So I've just been doing them all in assembly line stages, so it'll be like, okay, I'm doing like all the browns today, so all the leathers, just like blocking in the base colors.
Okay.
And then one other model that I worked on was an old Games Workshop model called Marco Colombo. That's basically their like
Zogs
Marco
of War?
Polo, Christopher Columbus meet. Because he was the front picture model for this Lustria event that was like, It's where they introduced like the Vampire Coast and all that stuff. So like Lord Markin and
pirate vampires,
like,
dude.
When they used to have like one of the best kits GW ever put out was half zombie kit, half Empire Militia kit. And it was zombies of the Vampire Coast.
Yeah.
And so they gave you like half and half, and you like kit bash pirate vampire or pirate zombies.
Was it was that all
it
was?
Like the named character for that. Yeah, it was literally just the two kits came in a baggie, because I bought like two or three of these and I kit bashed a bunch of them way back when.
Okay.
And it was just literally they used to have these, I forget what to call it, but it was like blue baggies that it had like a clear front, and it was just like their generic bag for everything that didn't have like box art or a box.
It was a clear bag, had the blue box label with Games Workshop in yellow, like metallic font thing. Yep.
Yeah, and it had just blue around the sides. and yeah, it was literally just they took 10 zombies worth of like sprue and 10 Empire Militia worth of
sprue.
They're
like, fucking figure it out.
Yeah,
you
and
figure
just
it
like,
out.
You fucking figure it out.
Bash it how you want.
Like, what did it look like? I don't know.
I don't know, dude.
It's and a that, skull with a fluffy hat.
Yeah. That militia kit, too, had so many bits. I still have bits
crossbows,
from
torches,
when I bought
everything.
Like two baggies of those things.
Yeah.
That's. I need to find time to spend time at the Bits Baron.
That's where I got it. This last year, I got it from the, what is it, Toledo Game Room, who does all the Bits stuff.
Yeah, I need to,
yeah.
I need to do that. I need to have a couple things in mind. You know, it's like, otherwise it's overwhelming to go there and look for bits because you're just like, I don't even know. So I do want to get those, but I can get some Necromunda bits.
Ooh, yeah. Or you could get some Barbarian bits for your Dark Oath armor you're definitely going to buy.
It's not a real army.
What is it?
It's slaves.
War Scrolls.
It's four War Scrolls. It's basically redoing and adding one or two new things to the Dark Oath side that is Slaves to Darkness. So
what?
Yeah, in that box that comes out with them, you get like the new Slaves to Darkness tome, I think, too.
Okay.
So it's
so
updated or something.
It's like Iron Jaws, where literally it's like a 30-page book, 40-page book, and it just adds those four war scrolls, just a crap ton of lore. But it's basically just like, hey, you have your Slaves to Darkness book. You now have to bring this with.
I'm still down
for these four or these four war scrolls. That was the one thing that shocked me. Is it's like, yeah, four new war scrolls, and I'm like, oh, that's only four things.
Yeah.
What is this, Flesh Eater Courts?
Yeah.
There are so many cool models though. There's Warcry's Underworld. There's you have some event exclusive model.
Yeah.
Right. And dude,
they're like some of my favorite because they're like evil Conan. That's their aesthetic, and it's like those are my two favorite things. Why? Tastes great together. So I just love them. But also it's like I would just love to paint a couple of them or to, you know, do like a Warcry warband with that kind of a thing, you know?
Dude, do it.
I don't think I could do a whole Age of Sigmar army. The next Age of Sigmar army that I'm going to do is when Skaven comes out. I'm fucking going full rats.
Why full rats?
Because I just love those little ratty boys. They were on my finals. Back in the day when I very first got into Warhammer, it was Age of Sigmar, into debating which army to pick, my final three, I had it narrowed down to three. One was the Death Army, because that's all it was at the time. It's just everything under Nagash.
Yeah, Legions of Death.
The other was Slaves to Darkness, because, you know, evil Conan. And the third was Skaven. Those were the final three that I was narrowed down to. And so I just like them. They're just, especially Eshin, okay? Ninja rats? Come on, dude. That's the best, you know? So I can't do I'll do the Slaves to Darkness, Dark Oath stuff for a smaller game.
What's last place for you? What's like despicable? You hate this army?
The fucking boat dwarves, skyboat dwarves.
Okay.
Ew.
Yeah.
Dang it. Kerdrin Overlords?
I think it's probably the last army I would play.
Where do Lizardmen lie in your rankings?
I like a lot of the Lizardmen.
Is this a targeted question?
Yeah. Yeah, Dan is the Lizard King.
That's what that Marco Colombo is for the, I'm doing the Warcry narrative on Saturday that I did not realize until emailing the guy is only 12 people. So it sounds like it's going to be super narrative, but you got to bring an NPC. And so my lizards with hats, my tiny little conquista lizards, are going to hunt down Marco Colombo.
Can I get his treasure?
He stole their shit.
Steal back their treasure. Yes. We can post pictures. We'll put them on the screen right now of Dano's, the Columbus conquistador lizard people, because they are both ridiculous and amazing.
Dremeling out tiny little empire hats to fit on chameleon skinhead. It's a great pastime of mine. I probably have just this manic expression on my face with a little rounded bit Dremel tool. Just
We actually also played a game of Warcry on the stream, and there's a VOD of that.
Yeah.
And I think at the end of that VOD, we get some really cool panning shots of all your models as well. So if you want to see some video, that'll also be down in the show notes.
Yeah, there's one thing you will very rarely see when you see Dan play a game or see the models that Dan does, and that is that they look like the models look like the models that were in the box. Dan always does some wild shit in it. And going back to our last episode of What Excites You in the Hobby, without even asking Dan that question, I can tell you that he loves to come up with his own little mad scientist ways to express his hobby. And I really appreciate that, which is why I'm okay with being Dan's drug dealer for 3D printed basing bits.
Yeah.
I wish I could show our Facebook Messenger conversations. The way Dan approaches me is like someone that really needs a meth hit. Like, he's like, hey man, hey man, you got any of them little pokey bushes left, man? I need some pokey bushes. Like,
how does it feel to have Ninjan be your 3D printing guy?
Yeah. It's great. Okay. He prints me all the gremlin stuff. I brought those, what were they? They were the Cobra Mode little fish, like Murloc looking dudes.
Yeah,
I brought
Murloc.
Those to kind of the north for the paint contest, and they got like gold in their category, but like so many people were just like, oh, where'd you get those? I love those. And I'm like,
like, Ninjan printed them for me, go ask him.
I didn't do the name drop thing, but I'm just like, buddy printed them because he knows I'm a gremlin at heart, and these are gremlin models.
Bit gremlin. That's awesome. Yeah, you should tell him about the one conversion you did for your cops.
Oh yeah. So Scott was talking a lot of trash before we started our league.
I'm a trash talker, dude.
which is on brand and great.
Yeah, dude, trash princes. Obviously, yeah. I'm going to talk trash.
And so it was great. So I asked Schaefer I'm just like, Schaefer, you have a little bit of everything for Necromunda, because that is his favorite game. He will forever talk about how it is like the best GW game, and I don't know anyone that really disputes it with him. Mm. And so he had a Cawdor box. So I borrowed the Cawdor box, and I took about what is it, like three quarters of a dude,
mm-hmm.
put it on a base, and I have my judge, because I use the Arbites models. Mm. So I have the judge, I kit bashed him, because eventually he's going to have like a shotgun too. But so he's got shotgun over one shoulder, hand on shield, shield pressing dude into ground. And it's on us, and I may or may not have painted it in Scott's.
You painted it in my fucking scheme as well.
Oh, yeah. That's what you get for putting your color scheme out on the internet,
Scott. Exactly.
Now people can paint it and use you
as basing to trophies.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
That's beautiful.
And then he kicked my ass first round.
That's so anticlimactic.
Yeah.
Dude, Jetty D?
Did Jetty D kill the dude with the...
Yeah, he killed his leader.
So, rough.
I don't know if he killed him or he just a serious injury.
You know what's the best part? So for me, having
it was a
not
crazy
gotten
fight.
Much out of a bunch of the first two games, like not getting a ton of credits, etc., not really, like still leaving with a bunch of, like not feeling like I really won the last game either. Like I have one lasting injury outside of the... You captured one dude,
yeah,
got him back. One dude went to the doctor and died that game, which was not the leader. That's the only detrimental thing I've had, like for my guys. I've had a guy like miss a game, but like as far as like injury rolls, I've had one dude die so far.
Yeah, yeah.
And like my leader was perfectly fine after that game. We rolled on the chart, and he didn't even miss the next game, which I'm just like, thank God.
Whew.
Yeah, that would be rough. That was a crazy combat because the Necromunda, whenever you hit someone in combat and you like they're able to hit you back, they can. It's a reaction attack. And so Dan and I went back and forth for three rounds. So like we probably got to swing both, each of us, six times until someone actually came out on top. And so it was actually a crazy combat. It was super cool.
I whiffed a lot.
Yeah. I think you did wound me at some point for sure.
Yeah, he was a good counter to my leader. The best part is like
he's got minus AP and high strength. Yeah,
well, minus AP, but the other thing is my shield has like a bash thing that like when I hit you, I can push you away. Which your guy having versatile, what is it, 1 inch or 2 inches?
1 inch versatile, yeah.
Yeah, which means he can be up to 1 inches away and still hit me. So I'd literally just be pushing him out of my melee range and then proceeding to not be able to hit him, and then him just being like.
He just fucking pokes you with the end of his stupid ass.
And the best part was, like, Dano, you had to, like, bait him into charging him with, like, his leader.
Yeah, yeah.
I
was like, brother Absalom, stand in the street. And then he did, and then he died.
Yeah. You just kept, like, throwing the smoke grenades and running up, and I'm like, I can't do anything about the smoke.
Can't do it. Gotta engage me.
I didn't have anything with templates other than the grenade launcher. So, like, I couldn't really do anything into the smoke, and I'm like, screw it, things need to happen. I charge my leader in, and then he just whiffed. And then his guy just, like, took off the first wound that first combat. And then, yeah, we went back and forth for, like, three combats before he took off that second wound. And I wounded, or I hit your guy and took a wound off once.
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, boy.
All right, well, anyways, talking about what we painted.
Yeah.
I think this turned into why everyone that listens to the podcast and plays Necromunda.
Yes. What'd you paint, John?
Oh, I brought some stuff with here.
Bringing some stuff. John brought some Golden Demon stuff with. He is still deep in the trenches. Well, maybe not so deep anymore. He's starting to dig his way out of Golden Demon painting. And so he brought his base.
Yeah, I crawled out. I did the math the other day. I did 11 straight days of painting at least 10 hours a day.
You are a master of moving that mic and staying with it with your shoulder.
Yeah. All right, so... The little man there with the big axe. Well, he's a big man with a big axe. He is the fifth and final model for the unit, my Cities of Sigmar unit. And then there is the base that they will all go on eventually.
Yo, you.
I love that Arch Knight model. It's one of my favorite models in that.
I did some switching with him. So first of all, I cut off the giant things on his shoulders, and that's not the helmet that he comes with. So I have his bare head under there. That's one of the helmets of the Cities of Sigmar standard cavalry. And I drilled out the inside of it and had it open so you could still see his face. And so, like, you know, his helmet was up. And so I wanted to still show that big, glorious ginger beard.
Yeah, he's got big, bushy beard.
Yeah, big, bushy
like
beard.
Sitting on top of the, I always forget what that armor piece is called. But that
the piece that's right there.
Like the coif?
Coif? No, yeah. it's a word. I don't remember. But yes.
The metal part?
Yeah.
Yeah, the cuirass.
Cuirass?
Yeah.
Okay. So
I think a coif is like the fabric garment version of it, essentially.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So I did those. And so with him being painted, I now officially have everything has paint on it in a level where if Golden Demon was tomorrow, I could glue them all on the base tonight and enter it tomorrow. So to the point where I got to put all the dudes on it with blue tack them all down in their places and figure out what tweaks I need to make.
Such an adult, dude.
I was like, I got in this weird groove by like day two or three of spending so much time every day where like it became my routine and I felt like I just need to always be painting. And that was like, I needed to just ride that wave because I felt like when I got off that wave, I'm going to lose all steam and I'm just going to be ready for Adepticon. So,
ABP.
So, which is kind of where I'm at right now. I'm nervous. Yesterday was my 11th day of painting nonstop. And so
what's the story on the chainmail in his right pit? It's painted like the fabric across his chest, but I believe it's chainmail.
Yeah. I thought it was fabric.
I mean, it could be whatever you want it to be, but like, I think, wouldn't it probably be chainmail?
Probably. Yeah, okay. Probably would. But I was like, I'd rather have a color that ties into the burgundy and red and stuff.
That's totally fine. I didn't know if it was like a thing that you base coated and then forgot about because it's so small. Yeah. But if that's your choice, totally, totally cool.
I'm gonna look at it again too and see if it fits because I painted his arms separately and his head separately. This is just about the only sub assemblies I did. And so his arms with the axe were a separate thing. And so where it connected was right at that part. So you could see it. It felt like a lot more obvious because it was a separate piece.
Okay.
And so it felt like, oh, it's just like a fluff or a coat or something underneath that's coming out.
Sure, yeah.
And I was like halfway through highlighting, I'm like, are these little rings? Fuck.
If anyone asks, it could just be like padded gambeson.
Exactly. Yeah. It could be anything.
Padded gambeson.
I don't know. I didn't know if you just like base coated it and then didn't see it. Did you feel like exhibit putting a plinth on your plinth?
Yeah, bro. Yeah, this is my 93 Honda with a spoiler and 20 inch rims. I'm gonna plinth on my plinth. I didn't want to once I got to a certain point with this, I'm like, or I took all the tape and all the stuff off of it, I was like, okay, I need to not be manhandling this. I still am going to have to go through and do another coat or two of Abaddon Black around that rim. Because somehow it has some little speckles. I don't know where the fuck they came from.
Is that it's Abaddon Black?
That's Abaddon Black.
It looks so matte.
It's airbrushed on like five coats. But yeah, I'm going to thin it down and with a fat brush, I'm going to go over it.
Okay, cool.
I was going to ask, so you have him pinned here. And just looking at the base, are you planning on pinning the models to the base, or are you just going to...
Nah, we're just going to raw dog it. I'm just going to set them there. They're not going to be...
Pinning is too risky. You're just going to set them there.
Yeah, pinning is risky. Yeah, you have that little bit of... You have this nice little window of when you just put a little tiny dot of super glue on their feet, you set them down about where they need to be, and then you kind of just fiddle them a little bit until they get right where they are. And if you pin, like, you can't undo that. Like,
yeah, you can't. You're stuck. You can rotate on that point, and that's it.
Yeah, so he goes right here in this brown spot.
I was going to say, I see, like, footprints, which is kind of great, too, because that also leads to that, like...
Yeah, I know exactly where he should be. He has a little bit of mud coming out of his... Yeah, so I have the doggy in front, and then he'll be right here. Ninja guy's over here. Man with head in a box is here. And then, of course, our big high marshal's on top.
Got a head in a box.
That's it. That's all I painted since our last episode.
Yeah. I just painted 60 hours in the last 5 days.
Also, probably as many hours as were spent on both of these, an equal amount of hours was spent on finishing that horse, which I didn't bring today, but that horse took so much time. Like, I remember last episode talking about how much time and how I thought I still only had 30% of it left. That was probably another 30 to 40 hours.
Yeah.
It was just so much.
So much stuff. So many details. One thing I said off camera was that I really liked how you went for a dark steel NMM. That's like something that I don't really know how to do that. The only kind of NMM steel I know how to do is like a kind of like a brighter silver or brighter plate. So that was cool that you did that. And then also the highlights he did on the base itself is done. Well, some of them at least are done with some kind of like a little bit of a light green. And so the brown turns into a yellow, turns into a green as it gets up to its highlights, which gives it a very like alive vegetation feeling.
That was actually, so is a slightly blue base gray color, Mechanica standard gray.
For the rocks or for everything?
For the rocks.
Okay.
Is that, and that is just a hint of blue in that gray and then building up from there. And then I glaze over my kind of universal warm highlight, which is Cassandra yellow, which is a shade paint that I just thin and glaze with, which is like if you see a little bit of yellow and this blade there, and there's actually some over everything. When I put that on the highlights of the stone, that yellow melded a bit with that grayish blue, and then you get that fun little green.
That feels
natural what happens when sunlight hits something like
that. Yeah.
So
that's really cool.
Pretty happy. Well, we might have more tufts going on once I get all the guys on.
Dude, tufts, baby.
But the story of this is that there is, you know, a recent attack in their city or their township or wherever, and these are buildings and like a bridge or walkway or something that recently was destroyed. So I don't want there to be a ton of vegetation, that they're there to like push back the evil or to guard an area that was attacked. So it shouldn't feel like the wilderness. So I tried to have it be just little bits of that.
Mm, this is like post Osgiliath gets retaken and Boromir's like hoisting the flag up and he was like, ah, and everyone's like, yeah,
exactly.
So the most you're going to see is like weeds in between the cobblestones, basically.
Yeah, stuff around the, I keep about to put this down and then I push the mic.
You're like, wait, no, one more thing.
That's right. Around the back, there's more vegetation around the base of the bridge because that bridge would have been an existing thing that would have had more vegetation around it and it hadn't crumbled. So there's more back there.
I like that.
Yeah.
I also really liked, you sent me the picture of the horse, just all the texturing for the leather too different types of leather having like different colorations really, really worked.
It's so hard when you have so many, forget how many small details have like their colors are just some form of brown. So every leather strap, every saddlebag, every backpack, you know, every, you know, the barding of the horse, all this stuff, it's all brown, but you can't make it all just be the same. Otherwise it's just like, it just becomes a big dull mess. So I tried to have different variations and different kinds of texture or the amount of wear on different pieces based on what they were. And I'm glad you appreciated that, Dan.
And like, it also brings a narrative to the sense of like, this dude's been around for a while. Mm-hmm. He's had to replace gear. He like might not get it from the same leather worker. Yeah.
Yeah. I try to do this middle ground with this unit where it's like, I don't want them, their gear to be all beaten up and worn and whatever, because they have a level of pride and honor in what they do and what they represent and representing their colors. So they don't let things get disheveled. However, I still want there to be a feel that these are not people that are just walking in their parade uniform, that they haven't seen action. So trying to find that middle ground of like, look, he is someone that the other soldiers look up to, being the High Marshal, and that he holds himself to that high standard, but he is also a grizzled veteran. How do we portray that with paint?
Mm. There's like a sense of use behind it.
Yes, yes. Okay, I see a bunch of cultists over there. What'd you paint, Scott? Men.
Green boys! So I did not paint as much as you did, but I'm back on that hobby video grind, and so every day of work for this week for me has been pretty much painting 8 hours a day. Or more, because I get here pretty early.
Doesn't it feel good? It
feels so good. Oh my God. For some reason, I think it was like Tuesday or something, I was like, dude, I get to fucking kitbash and paint this Necromunda gang as a job. And I almost started weeping. I was just like, this is so cool. And like, that's all I'm doing. And then when I'm done, I'm gonna write the script and I'm gonna shoot some sick B-roll. I asked John Schaefer to give me some Necromunda terrain and I'm gonna like take some amazing like GW-esque fog rolling in teal backlit like sunlit sky like shots. It's gonna be so fucking sick. I cannot wait. And I love all that. I love all of it. I love the hobby aspect. I love the writing. I love the shooting, the videography. I love everything about it. So I can't wait. I'm so excited. But yeah, it's amazing. But I have several different groups of things to show you guys.
Okay.
The three-man group on the side, on the right side, was already painted, but they had the wrong weapon. And so I chopped off like the front portion of the weapon and then kit-bashed like what looks like a flamethrower for all three of them. That's the weapon they have, and I want them to have the right weapon. I did it with some bits that you gave me and some of my own bits. The one I'm most proud of is the one... this guy with the candle on his shoulder. Like, because that long, thin, cylindrical gas tank, that like I
love that.
I know, and like I used just some string bit that I had, or a string bit. I used some string that I had from like Joann's fabric or something. And when you put super glue thin on it, it like just turns into plastic.
Yeah, it petrifies.
Yeah, yeah. And so it just works. It's the right scale. It's almost the same as the ones around their neck and stuff.
Oh, it's cool.
I was gonna say it ties in super well.
Yeah, yeah. So I felt good about that.
The metal grates.
Yeah, yeah. That scale model mesh that I got from the scale model supply. It's like a super thin to scale, like chain link fence material.
Oh, yeah, I need to get some of that.
It's super nice. Yeah. It's super nice. It's also super nice to work with. It's like really easy to cut. And so I could cut super accurate, thin, like little rectangles to do that mesh thing with. Like the other stuff I've had is like not easy to do that with. So it looks kind of like haggard and shitty when you cut it.
God, that tank is so good. It's a tiny little detail that you, when you say that you kind of kit bashed that into place to be there, I'm like, damn, that looks like that was a really fun design.
It was
innate to the sculpt. Like it looks.
Oh,
like,
thank you.
I would not have guessed that that's something you added.
Thank you. Yeah. And like the cabling is aluminum wire, which if you guys don't have any aluminum wire, you got to get some. It's so easy to bend and it looks like it's like the right scale for cabling. It's so nice. And then, so that's the first thing I did, a little bit of weapon changes. The guy in the middle is who Jetty D used to be. I popped his head off and gave him two new weapons, a new sniper rifle and like the wrench mallet thing. I don't know. I fucking love it. Yeah. It's like a hand tool.
Yeah.
And he got nicknamed Sweet Beak, Beak So Sweet, He'll Give You a Cavity by John Schaefer.
Wow.
I had to repaint the skin cause like I painted the skin with Monument Hobbies paints and it was like a real like olive Mediterranean skin tone.
Mm-hmm.
So I repainted his arm and it's like his back ankle. Any skin you can see like on his arm and his hand with like a kind of more of an olive palette. And then the other guys on the far right, those are just new, repainted at home or on a live stream and got finished in the last like week or week and a half or whatever. I love that, the checkered head thing.
I was going to say, I love that you're starting to add like the checkers in there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was at home and I couldn't prime or anything, so I don't have like a priming setup at home, and I was like, fuck it, dude, I'm just gonna paint this head with bare plastic on bare plastic on sprue, and so that's just what I did, and it looks fucking fine.
you never know.
Right. And so you mentioned that thing about primer just needs to have a tooth, and so the first layer of black paint I put on his head was so shitty.
Yeah.
And then after that, totally normal painting.
Yep.
It just gives you that layer of adhesion and grip.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the new guys. These two guys are just whips of gangers. They'll be done today or tomorrow. Or sorry, today or Monday. They're not necessarily special.
Are you going to do more? Because I really do like that checker pattern. Are you going to add that more around other parts of the models?
Yeah.
Because I really think that's a cool little way to add some differentiation while it still feels like it fits the scheme so well.
I think so. I think I'm going to. I definitely stole that idea from the box art. They do checkers on the main leader guy, this guy, on his like his what I don't know, what's that called? The shoulder, like the little tiny shield.
Oh, for jousting.
Yeah. So they painted that with checkers on this guy, and I was like, oh, okay, I'm definitely gonna lift that. And the last cool thing I did for my Necromunda was the new Jetty D, who uses a Dreadblade Harrow greatsword for his big fucking greatsword now. So he doesn't have his axe anymore. This is the headsman model for Cawdor. And he also uses the whetstone grinding bit from the Underworld's kit.
He's an Underworld's warband. I forget what it's called. Like the headsman's curse, I think.
Oh, that sounds right. Yeah. And then he uses just some random ass Cawdor arm that I had to cut off and shave and sand a million times until like the angle of that whetstone matched the angle of the blade. I had to be like super careful about when I actually glued things in so I didn't like commit to anything that like wasn't like undoable. So I did like, you know, I pinned the hand into the guard and then the other part into the other side of the hand, tried to make sure it was straight, and then I glued the arm in, and then I like made sure that the hand came in at the right area. It's kind of unnatural because you wouldn't like grunt, you wouldn't sharpen your blade like that, right?
Yeah.
So it looks a little awkward, but I kind of, you know, you had to work with the bit that you have.
It's like very intimidating pose though.
Yeah.
It looks like, oh, he's just slowly grinding that, waiting for you to come closer.
Yeah.
It's going to end badly for you.
Yeah. But those are, I'm painting all three of those at the same time.
It's such a good open pose model.
I know. And you
changing that to the axe with the whetstone hand, you didn't disrupt that. So it really fits it well.
Yeah. That was a really fun, subtle conversion. I did a little bit of gap filling and that felt good. And it's nice and subtle.
Well done.
Thank you. Yeah. Felt good. And the guy who sculpted all this Cawdor stuff is Tom Hughes.
Really?
Yeah. And so I just want to give a shout out to him because he made a bunch of really cool bits that can be like mixed and matched really easily. And I think that's really cool because you can make a bunch of unique gangers without too much effort.
Is that the flame weapon that comes in the upgrade, or is that another one, the guy in your left hand?
This one is all them. I didn't make that.
One official one in your warband now?
Yes, like I have two. If you buy the upgrade kit, you get two of them. So I have two here. But yeah, I had to kit bash the other three. Because I have three, because I'm a bastard.
Yeah, war crimes. It's a war crime stick.
It really is.
Other question, are you going to do any like burnishing on the ends of the flame weapons and stuff? Like,
burnishing?
Like any of like the actual, like, you know how like when you have like a fire pit, how it'll blacken around the edges?
Like ashy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I kind of do that metal discoloration from all the heat from a barrel, gun barrel too.
I feel that'd be a really cool thing. You ever feel like when you're getting close to the end of a paint job, you kind of want to just have it be done so you can look at it and be excited about it?
Yeah.
I was kind of feeling that after like converting them and repainting them. I was like, okay, they're done. They look pretty now. But I think that would be cool if I did like to take some like dry, like black pigment and like kind of powder it on the edge or something like that.
I've done that. I did that in the big kit bash I did of the Creature Caster Plus War Dog model, the big Chaos War Dog that I did. I did that on one of his rail guns because I was at the same point. I'm like, I want to do something cool with this, but I don't want to spend a lot of time. And that just... a black pigment powder works so well for that because it's so matte and it just looks like that bit of kind of corrosion and exhaust that settles there.
Mm.
Just do that.
Yeah. Okay.
And you know those scrubs aren't cleaning their weapons.
Definitely not.
No.
Definitely not.
The trash men don't clean their stuff.
All right. We're here to really grill Dan on everything hobby store that there is to know. So before we get into it, Dan, I'm going to give you an open-ended question, and it's okay if you can't think of anything off the top of your head. Is there anything that you can think of that the average goody peepee out there that spend their time in a game store would be surprised to learn or surprised that this is the reality of either working at a game store, of running a game store, how it all works? Is there anything you're like, you know, most people wouldn't know this, but they should know this?
I mean, the big thing, like one of our interview questions we kind of ask people is like, are you okay with that thing you enjoy, that thing you do for fun, also being very close to your work in the sense of like, hey, you're going to be doing a bunch of monotonous things around that thing. Is that going to dull your sense of that? Are you okay with that if it does?
I wouldn't think that'd be like a question you would care to ask, you know?
Yeah, because it's one of those things where it's like, oh yeah, no, I love magic cards. I love looking at cards, blah, 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 blah. It's like, okay, well, if you're forced to go through like 3,000 cards as quick as possible, like, is that something that's going to dull your sense of enjoyment of that thing? And some people it's a yes, and some people it's just like a, like for me, the magic card example, like I'm very big on like, I love sorting that kind of stuff or going through kind of all that stuff, but like, I can also go through like a 5-row box in like half an hour to an hour if you really just like don't interrupt me whatsoever, which is sometimes hard to do at work. But
it's very hard to do. Whenever I play a miniature war game with you at the source, Dan, you have people constantly asking you questions.
Yeah. But yeah, that's one of the big things that kind of like people sometimes don't realize is you guys experience this all the time. But like it's taking that thing that's your enjoyment, your passion, but also making it a job where it's like, okay, you do have things that you have to do. Like we make those pre-sorted magic bricks where we take a lot of commons and uncommons, splash some rares on each side and in the middle and what have you, and then just kind of shrink wrap them and sell them as like a, hey, this helps you build your collection, that kind of stuff. That thing, like that's one of the easiest ways to tell if it's like someone that's a big magic person. if I give them the task of assorting that stuff, because I personally take a point of pride that we mix it up where it's not just like, oh yeah, clearly they just cracked, you know, Modern Horizons 2. My entire brick is like Modern Horizons 2 stuff, and I got 37 of the same card. Cool.
Yeah, you don't want to do that.
Like, we basically try and make sure that you're, as much as we can avoid it, not getting a, like a, more than a playset or two of a thing, and then trying to make it as many different colors, as many different sets as possible. So we have people kind of go through with those big sorting trays and then just mix it up, and it's kind of like an ancillary task while at register. But like, some people you can tell, like, when they're not quite ready to kind of have that separation of those things where they can like buckle down and treat it as work, they'll sit there and like, oh, look at this card. Look at this card. And it'll be like, oh, you've got a pile just as big of what we had you sorting of things that you're just like, oh, can I buy these?
Yeah, it's problematic.
Which is yeah, it's like not the end of the world, because it's like, yeah, we still want you to be passionate about it, but also it's one of those things where it's like, hey, we still, at the end of the day, like, the longer you're taking doing that thing, the more the overhead cost is on that thing, and where it's like something that should be profitable for the store, suddenly if you're taking so long doing it, and like...
Yeah, man hours are eating into the profits of it.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Give us a sense of scale, Dan. How many employees approximately? What's the square footage of the stores? How many products you have? Like, so, if you know the answer to those questions.
Yeah. The number of products is really tough. The square footage is roughly, I want to say we're roughly like 12,000 square feet.
Okay.
And,
which is big.
Yeah,
it's
which is
very big.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's half of what used to be a bowling alley. Apparently, it also used to be like a Hollywood Video.
Oh, yeah.
I
went there all the time.
Yeah. But yeah, so it's physically just a big store. And then number of employees, I think we're up to like 28 or 29 right now. We do have a lot of people that are part-time, just because we have a lot of people, like my coworker Kelly, the one that taught me framing and mat cutting. Like, he works a day job at a print company, which is how like he gets all that mat board and stuff. Like, he has space to work on that and make his own mat board with like paper samples and stuff. Like, he has a full-time day job. He does a bunch of other stuff, and he basically comes in whatever Friday and Saturday nights I can get him after he's done working, and he'll go through and go through all the old comics and get price labels made. So it'll be stickers saying like, oh, this is the first appearance of Vigilante, and it'll have the price sticker, and it'll tell you like the issue number, all that stuff, and like, he'll have that kind of stuff made, and he'll be able to go through and process that stuff. But he only does that for like 3 to 6 hours a week.
Okay. So a lot of employees, 30, yeah, about 30 employees. And in your role at the source is you are a manager, right?
Yep. Yeah.
All right. Cool. Cool.
It was floor manager. We had the other person that was doing a lot of the event stuff left and got the last like 2 months. So now it's also like events manager is the other title that keeps getting floated around.
Okay.
Because Dave is kind of generally more the floor manager, because he basically sticks up front.
Okay.
So yeah, we have a couple of us that are managers. We have about 5 managers.
Which is a lot for a game store.
Yeah.
Usually it's like, exactly, you own this, you're the store owner / the manager, and then everybody else.
Yeah, / janitor.
/ everything. Yeah. And the source has been around for a long, long time.
Yeah.
I remember it back when it was further south on Snelling, where it's like the Warner Stallion now in that corner, back when I was in, just got out of college. That is where the source was, and I loved it back then. And it was a big store too. But how long have you been there?
It's been mostly since I moved back up to the cities, because I went to college out here, moved back home for like a year and a half, and then almost immediately came back to the cities, which was like 9 years ago. So I think I've been at the store like 8 years.
Okay.
So yeah, long time.
I kind of remember your ascendance through the ranks being quite quick.
Yeah, we had some personnel issues. So there was one manager that was problematic, and so there's a whole big hullabaloo about that.
Okay.
And then one of the things that came out of that was like, that manager left. That's when our current general manager, who's the owner's son, was just like a regular kind of like manager shift lead, got bumped up. And then, it was one of those things where they're like, hey, it makes sense to have you as a manager. And that's when I became the floor manager, because they're like, hey, your task is basically just make sure people are up by register, make sure everything in the front goes good. make sure people are happy, like
customers
and employees. Like, trying to make sure that like people stay happy, and if people have needs, like advocating for that kind of thing.
Okay.
Which is something that I take very seriously, because like it's a family-owned business, so things aren't always going to be perfect. So trying to advocate for that as much as possible, and basically be like, and especially when you have 28 people, even though some of them are only there a couple of days a week, like you still get a lot of personalities mixing, stuff like that. Things that may bother some people won't bother others. And so basically making sure everyone feels like their issues are acknowledged and addressed. And like, yeah, that's a big part of that too.
Okay. Give us a rundown on like your weekly responsibilities. Like, what do you do in your role, like at the Source? You kind of just gave us some of those things.
Yeah.
Is it different every week? Is it
yes.
kind of the same? Oh my gosh, because it changes.
Yeah, it's, okay. I mean, I basically run around screaming like a pterodactyl all the time.
Okay.
But no, it's a lot of different tasks. Now with the event stuff takes up a huge chunk of my time. I was doing all the GW stuff for a while.
What does that mean to do the GW stuff?
Which is just like doing reorders, making sure the shelves look nice, making sure... that stock levels are okay, things like returns. Like right now on my podium, I have like three different boxes that I emailed my rep basically being like, hey, these are damaged. Like, can we get a credit back for these? And then basically we have to wait till they respond either yes or no, or if they have to have us return it. That kind of stuff, like that kind of back and forth, getting new releases ordered. Yeah, I broke down restocks. So like every month I would basically do, first week would be like 40K reorder. Second week would be my AOS reorder. Third week would be paints and hobby supplies. And then the fourth week would be like specialist games. So I basically went through every like 3 or 4 months, they'll send us like a new like, hey, here's all the stuff available through trade, like a trade order, order list. And I'll basically break up that order list into those chunks. So then for that 3 months or so, I can then just go through each one of those as a different like tab on my spreadsheet, go through, I actually like walk the wall, make sure that stuff is like, hey, we're not just reordering the same thing 6 times because we think we need to. It's like actually looking, because that stems from kind of another issue, is like our live inventory system is not great because sure. of the comic side of things.
It's hard to keep track of all that stuff.
Yeah.
So in a perfect world, do each of your managers own a portion of the store and is responsible for reordering and making sure it looks pretty and stuff like that? Or is it one person that has ownership of all that stuff?
Kind of. We break things out as much as we can just so nobody gets like super, super overwhelmed with stuff. It's like we have one manager that does CCGs, but also does a bunch of the front end stuff. We have, I mean, the general manager is doing more of the behind-the-scenes stuff, like payroll, making sure things like benefits and stuff. Like, we have a really, really, really nice benefits package,
Damn.
Which is one of the ways that they take care of us. And that's something that isn't typical for a game store, but it's something that the owner of our store has always, because we used to have 3 owners. Regrettably, the other 2 have passed in the last, like, 10 or so years. One about last year, the year before, and then the one about right before I started at the store, the third one had passed. But so the current owner still keeps up that, like, hey, we want to make sure your benefits are really great because you'll never be rich here, but we want to make sure we take care of you as much as we can. And that's one thing that they take a personal point of pride, and I think they do very well.
I think Dan's fishing for a raise right now. I wanted to real quick jump in here, Dan, because you talked about something that I think a lot of the listeners and Scott and myself as well have had pain points in or frustrations with over the years, and that is doing pre-orders, specifically for Games Workshop, but other, you know, distributors as well. What's your experience in dealing with, because if you've had to do the pre-orders for like the next big, you know, Leviathan box set and all this, has it been frustrating in dealing with Games Workshop? Do they tell you they're going to get you Xboxes, and do you get Xboxes? Do you like, you know, like there's all these things, and I've heard it from different game stores about saying they just never sent us blah blah blah, and I always like side eye look at them like, are you just passing the buck here? Frustration about getting new products when I want to get new products in the store. So specifically for Games Workshop, but also larger throughout the other sides of the store. Yeah.
Yeah. Answer yes.
Vacant face. So,
yeah.
Where do I begin?
Pre-orders were a really, really big thing. GW just in the last like 2-3 months, like basically towards the start of this year, swapped their pre-order program where essentially it used to just be like the week before you guys would get like the preview on the website. Before that hits customers and they get to see like, oh yeah, this is going up for pre-order next week. That's when we would have our orders due. They used to not tell us what we were getting for sure until after that pre-order weekend where customers could order stuff on the website. So if it's something where I thought we might get allocated or shorted, we do have an account for like the website that is a trade account. I would literally just go on there, even though we get less margin with that, I would literally go on there and just have to order extras with the hope that just like, if we don't get what I asked for, this will get me at least enough to cover pre-orders, that kind of thing. Like the Seraphon box set was a big one where I'm just like, I'm just going on the website because the last big box set we got allocated down to like two. And we have like six pre-orders. Cool. I'm going to go through and at least order six.
And it's so wild that you have to go out of your way to buy the thing as a store through their own website. Also,
with less margin too is the best.
Yeah, and you're making less money off of doing that. Also, like, if your local game store doesn't go your extra mile for you, like Dan is talking about that he does for his customers, you need to have a long, hard talk with your owner of that game store. Because like that, I know that that sucks, but not everyone will do that, Dan. I know
I
a lot
he's
of
the
my
exception, local, right?
Dan like, is the exception, but Dan should be the rule.
Some
That's
of
why
it's also tough to. To speak for like other people's experience with like, we have a trade account for the web store. Not everyone does. So like I know at least now two or three other stores in the cities that do, like Hub Hobby started doing that after a point. Cause I remember being in there, I was talking to one of the regulars that's a regular there and with us.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, I pre-ordered this thing. Yeah. Like I just put in my pre-order yesterday for this thing. And then I get back to the store the next day, because it was my Monday off, and I just like pop by there like almost every Monday, and it's dangerous.
It is dangerous, dude.
And that place is so dangerous for me to spend too much money.
It,
but so like I was just there listening, and then I literally was sitting there at my little wheelie podium working on a GW reader, and then it dawned on me like 24 hours later, I'm like, that's a web store exclusive. They don't do web store exclusives. So I reached out to like the manager I knew there and was just like, hey, y'all, just a heads up, I was talking to one of your regulars. He mentioned he pre-ordered this thing through you guys. I know it's a web store. I know you guys don't do web store. You should definitely consider it. And they did. They signed up for it, but it was like too late for that particular thing because it sold out. But I'm just like, hey, we can sell you this one at cost. So we were able to like help them out.
Amazing.
But like, wow. It was one of those things where like, customers hadn't asked enough because there's so many things that like customers will be like, I really wish they did that thing, not say a word to the people working and just waddle back out.
Yeah.
And so like it was something that people hadn't really asked for, and then suddenly they started to do that, and I see like they'll order stuff in and I won't see it the next week, which tells me like, oh yeah, like that's something that's selling for them that people just weren't asking for, were like too afraid to ask for, or like they wouldn't go out of their way to ask for it.
Sure. Yeah.
And so like that's a big thing too, is like some store, like they had to talk to their rep and their rep had them have to jump through like a bunch of hoops for it, but their rep never brought that up to them that that was even an option.
Yeah. I've heard a lot of rep stories of like they go through so many and the training isn't sufficient, so the reps aren't given all the tools to be able to support you in the way that you deserve to be and need to be, and hopefully. So you're saying the last 2-3 months it's changed now? You're saying you seeing a better version?
So the new system is basically when we would put in those pre-orders, the end of that week, they will send you an email with like, hey, here is what we're actually fulfilling for you. So before it hits the website for customers, like front-end customers, we should know what we get. There was, I know the old world had some snafus with that because everything was a mess for that. That whole release was a giant headache. Between like half of it being web store exclusive and the other half of it, like stores getting out. We were lucky, but like initially, like one of the other friendly local game stores, like that we're friends with, one of their employees gave me a call and was just like, so how many of these books are you getting? And I told them the numbers that we were getting. It was like somewhere in the 30s was what we were supposed to get. They still had to refix their numbers later that day and sent out an email being like, oh, hey, those numbers were wrong. And that's the first time that they've had that, which had me very worried that that would become a consistent thing. But so far, knock on pleather, so far that hasn't happened. But that time, literally, they were like told they were allocated like 4 books.
Oh, yikes.
And he ordered like almost as many as we did. And so like he was in a panic, just like, what the heck is going on? Mm-hmm. But it's supposed to be, we get that number and that is like exactly what you are getting. Even if it sells out on the website, even if GW accidentally oversells on the website, they're not supposed to be cutting our orders. But like then that way we know going into that pre-order weekend, like, oh, hey, we got cut down to X. Cool. I need to go to the website and order that if I have the ability.
So there's a different payment for the trade account versus going through your rep. Like it's a better rate going through your rep.
No, the rep and the trade account is the same. Or are you talking like trade account on the website?
Yeah, on the website.
Yeah. So anything through the website is like basically, I don't know if I'm supposed to talk about exactly.
You don't have to. You don't have to.
It's like a percent cut off. Yeah. Because it goes through a whole different system. So, and there's different things available. So like all the Lord of the Rings stuff, if you're ever in the store and see like the white or black boxes with no art on them,
yeah,
that's all web store stuff.
Okay.
Cause some stuff basically, if it sells a consistent amount, they'll keep it on trade. And then as stuff kind of stops selling as much, they move it to web store.
Okay.
Cause the trade is supposed to be stuff where like stores are stocking this consistently as much as they can is kind of their, intention is that you will stock this consistently.
Okay.
That kind of stuff. So like there's a bunch of Necromunda stuff that's on there, but like a bunch of Lord of the Rings stuff that's not. Like trade list for Lord of the Rings is very small, which makes me a little bit sad because we have a really big group, but it's something that we're lucky enough. We have a big group for that game and we have a web store account so we can order that. Yeah, we don't get as much, but it makes those like, we'll sometimes get 12 to 16 people playing that game on a Tuesday. So it's like,
yeah.
I want to make those people happy because they're consistently showing up every week. The organizer is just this lovely, lovely human that will go through and be like, hey, you're starting this army here. Let's help you list build that kind of stuff. And not even just like pushing sales, but we'll be like, hey, like,
I thought I was like, okay, you're playing Minas Tirith, all right? Yeah. He's deciding for everyone.
Yeah. No, the problem is then everyone plays like 4 armies because people will be like, oh, it's not a lot of models for this army. Okay, cool. Oh, look, look at Easterlings look cool. Cool. Let me get a second army. Look at this third one over here. Let me just grab that.
That's the classic hobby issue.
Yeah. Lord of the Rings has it real bad because it's not big armies, so it's really easy to just collect like 4 or 5 different armies really quickly.
Yeah. So is GW like the worst company that you have to deal with in terms of like keeping stock quantity? And I want to like kind of dial it back a little bit. After having to deal with Atomic Mass Games like bullshit and and their like release schedule and stuff like that, and also CMON with a Song of Ice and Fire and like getting out update cards, getting a new product. Yeah. Like it appears that global logistics supply chain is a very complicated matter.
Yeah.
And so we get GW a lot of shit, but for like, you know, like not sending a company all of the product they expect, that sucks. And that's annoying for them, but also it's a complicated thing to deal with logistically, I imagine. But if you remember when Ollie was on here, do you remember what company he said was like the most annoying to deal with?
Asmodee.
Yeah. Well, yeah, do you have one for you?
We're spoiled because Asmodee is literally like a mile down the road.
Yeah.
So like our reps will literally come in and talk to us like personally sometimes. So like we get spoiled for Asmodee, so it's not as big of a pain, but they still have problems. Like my coworker Scott and I kept joking about you wanted the Darth Vader set.
I did.
How it was like in this weird liminal space where every time you thought about it, it got pushed back.
It did.
Three.
Yeah, it took forever to come out.
Time Scott thought about it, it gets pushed back.
People were like posting
Moff Gideon and the Dark Troopers look really good.
Yeah. And we got a release date for Eden Versio too.
Yeah.
And that's gonna be like December.
Yeah. It's like July now.
Yeah. Yeah.
December later.
Yeah.
You guys are talking in words that I don't like. I feel like you're a bunch of Welsh people here that I can't understand a word you're saying.
Just all Scottish.
Yeah. No, I can understand Scottish people just fine. I had this conversation with Scott Pryor that I'm watching the great British Throwdown, which is it's the Great British Baking Show, but it's pottery. You love it, Dan. It's freaking great. It's a great reality show, and it's like purely calm reality show, British style, you know? There's no drama. But in this current season I'm watching, there's a lady contestant on there, and she's from Wales. And she speaks in English, and I can't understand a word she says. I can't understand anything. And I'm sorry, I don't, if this is racist, I apologize, but like, I can't understand that accent at all. So what you guys just said, where you were talking about the SMG 40, you know, droid trooper kit, whatever, I'm like, I don't know what language you're speaking. You sound like you're from Wales.
All right, Dad, yeah. Go to bed.
Just makes me think of, what was it, Hot Fuzz, where Simon Pegg's character is talking to that one farmer, and they need the old cop to translate.
Yeah. Yes.
Just old dude with a heavy accent.
Yeah, dude. Yeah, that was pretty difficult.
So, okay. All right. Yeah. Do you have another hard-hitting question?
Wait, did you answer the question?
Not quite.
Oh, right.
Wizards of the Coast is real bad.
Oh.
Because, like, those numbers... Actually, a lot of card game stuff is really rough. But, yeah, COVID had made things worse, especially for card games, because there's, like, a big bubble. Bubble's kind of gone down a little bit. Like, there was a point where we had, like, it's almost, like, 400 names down for Pokemon pre-orders.
Oof.
And, like, before that, like, it was just, like, the Kids League and the, like, those parents, like, being like, yeah, I want to order this product or that product. Which would be like a dozen people, and it was at a point where it was up to like 400 people and then dipped down. So like trading cards had a huge, huge, huge boon. But so like because of that, any of these card games that are coming out are having problems getting like stock of paper, stock of foiling materials, that kind of stuff. So like my partner and I have really been enjoying the One Piece card game. I love One Piece. It's fun. I love the property. I like the card game. It's pretty easy to get into. We have a really good local community around it of people that really care about it and are really fun. But getting stock of that, like right now people are paying like for the most recent set, people are paying like $15 a pack for like roughly $5 MSRP packs because nobody has it. It's like not available through distribution. Every time we've ordered One Piece stuff, we get like 30% of what we order. Real rough. So like,
is that Wizards of the Coast too?
That's Bandai.
Okay.
But like Wizards of the Coast is having some similar stuff where it's just very erratic, which makes it very hard. And like they're changing their product lines. Like you know so much about this, just being a big Magic fan. Like things like, oh yeah, we're not doing set specific Jumpstart. Here's the Clue edition with packs that literally say shuffle up and play on them, which is basically just Jumpstart. Yeah. They're literally just Jumpstart packs, but with Clue different packaging name. Like you take the mask off and it's just Jumpstart. Jumpstart with extra steps, literally.
It's been me the whole time.
So like knowing what to order for that, but then also not knowing if like suddenly it's like, is this going to be a hot in demand item? Like a couple of coworkers were at Gamma this last week, and I was kind of telling you this earlier, talking about the Fallout stuff. Fallout collector packs, like I asked for more. I did my initial order and then asked for more of the commander decks, but I'm like, the collector packs should be fine. And then a couple of my coworkers that were at Gamma were talking to other stores and them being like, yeah, we got cut down to like 4 or 5 boxes of collector boosters. I got what I normally ordered, which is a lot more than that. But so like we didn't get cut super hard, but a lot of other stores did. So like some stores got cut, like if they normally would order maybe like 12 boxes, like they got like 3 or 4.
Okay, like so kind of similar
like
issues.
Because, it's like, especially with some of that stuff where Wizards is doing stuff that can only be one and done print runs. So like how they did the whole One Ring thing.
Yeah.
Where any time that they do serialized cards, because they advertise that as in that type of pack, those serialized cards, there's only so many of them. If they ever want to reprint that type of pack for that set, so like the Fallout set has the bobblehead numbered cards. They can't reprint that as the exact same thing. They can't just do another print run. They have to put out a whole new product because they advertise that those bobbleheads would be in that product with those numbers. So they have to do a whole new print run for that. So with that, it's like really hard to guess like, okay, is this going to be a hot one or is this not? Like Doctor Who, we had like 0 people hardly ordering any of it for like the booster packs, what have you. So I ordered lower. And then suddenly everyone was coming out of the woodwork for it. So it was one that I probably shot too low on. But like Fallout,
how are you supposed to know, right?
Yeah, it's challenging. There's no way to know. And that's part of like kind of having your finger on the pulse, which there's probably a little bit of that I could be doing better myself. But at the same time, like with the size of the store we are, I pulled in too many different directions for other things as well.
Yeah.
I think collectible card games are an especially tricky monkey because... they're fluctuating in value and price. And so you as a store, like if I buy 5 boxes of Leviathan and only one sells it'll sit on my shelf for basically that same MSRP. And then, you know, it's taking up shelf space and, you know, hopefully they eventually go away. But like with card games, the fluctuation of what the value is on the current market, not just in your store, but in the current market of these cards, and then what you paid for them at launch, you don't want to be sitting on a ton of inventory. You have to be really careful about that. So it's such a moving target. You know, you want to hit your pre-orders for any product, but for those, you don't want to over-order because, you know, a box of cards that's usually like $170, $180 within 90 days, that'll be selling online, even like on Amazon or whatever. It could be $80. Like it could be selling for less than what your cost was for it. So it's like it's scary as a store for going under, which leads to my next question, Dan, another hard-hitting question I've got for you. It's no surprise to hear that many game stores, FLGS stores, do not last very long. Like the half-life of a game store is like 3 to 5 years. You obviously are very connected in the community of the Twin Cities and know a lot of other people in other game stores. You've probably seen stores die, close, some that have been around for a long time. Do you have any insight on what makes a game store successful? Could be a detail, could be an overarching kind of theme. What is the difference between those that stay open and those that seem to kind of crumble?
Sometimes it's hard to judge. Some of it is just keeping your finger on the pulse, knowing what to go for, making sure that you're making the best use of your time. And trying to think of the best way to describe what, because it's really hard to judge because you don't necessarily know the inner workings of stuff like that.
Sure.
Not spreading yourself too thin too fast, because there's stuff that I've seen where like businesses will open extra stores.
Yeah.
So like especially during COVID, you had people opening a ton of extra stores, things like that. Like, oh yeah, we'll have one here, we'll have one here, we'll have one here. And then suddenly like that card bubble bursts.
Yeah.
You don't have that infrastructure anymore to support what that store needed to be bringing in. Or stretching beyond your means, that kind of thing. So like, us as a store have always had a policy. The owner has always had this big policy of we own whatever comes into the store. So like we don't do terms, things like that. And we're lucky enough to have that. Mm. We it got built up enough over time where that's something that we can afford to do. That's not always the case by any means. But so we're buying everything before it comes in, because if suddenly it's like, oh, you have a bad month and you can't continue paying those bills, they might not send you your next thing.
Okay.
Kind of like I listened to the podcast with Jason because I was curious what he had from the other side of that and like what he used to do for Games Workshop, where it's like, hey, you need to bring your bill current before we can send you new stuff. That kind of like immediate stop on your supply is that is no more money coming in for that particular product line.
And that's a snowballing effect.
Once you're behind, you frequently can find yourself staying behind, that kind of thing. Mm. But so a big thing is like making sure that like you're keeping up with that stuff, or like, which largely comes down to like ordering the right numbers of things.
Sure.
Because if say you spend $20,000 on a new Magic release, the faster that $20,000 can come back in means you're recuperating your costs, but then anything after that is gravy that can help afford other things.
Right.
That's an interesting thing about retail that I didn't really think about until actually I had Jason over at my house and we were like chatting, and he was like talking about an instance where like they didn't order the right number of packaging for their paint. Like they had run out, and Jason's like, what are you guys doing? Like this like product for a retail company is like the literal lifeblood of it. Yep. So if you're not stocking any element of that that can be stocked, like if it's in your power to do it, you must keep it up. And that's something that I ran into with keeping the Duchess in stock. It's like when I don't keep that model in stock, a portion of my revenue like goes down for the month. And so I have to really stay on top of that number. And I imagine you do to like the nth degree.
Yeah.
And Jason as well, to like make sure like you can keep making money.
And that's where like for us, like Jason and them don't have the same luck of everything goes up for pre-order. At least for them, they have stores ordering X amount so they know how much they need to get ready before a release. But for us, like our lifeblood is like, hey, stores doing pre-orders and making sure that you're getting those pre-order numbers. So that's when, like, if GW is messing with that, if Wizards is messing with that, that can really screw over stores. Because if people lose that consistency of, hey, I pre-ordered this thing, oh, you didn't fill it for me, and they get upset and they don't come back, that makes it, those pre-orders help you really know what to order ahead of time. And so that's where I always push people. Like, our process is we don't charge for it ahead of time. And this doesn't necessarily work for every store either, but like, we don't charge for it ahead of time. We warn people if it's something like One Piece, we just hit a point where we're just like, hey, just a heads up, we probably can't fill any more orders. We will see what we can do. Mm-hmm. But we don't take any money ahead of time. So if that doesn't sell within that first week, we have the freedom to be able to put it back out on the shelf if it's a hot ticket item.
Mm.
So like things like Pokemon, where a lot of stores were having problems where they're just like, hey, we had all these people asking about this Pokemon. We ordered a ton ahead. If they didn't either have that confirmed money from pre-orders or people not ordering, suddenly when that bubble bursts on that card game a little bit,
no one's coming
in with all that product. Yeah. And then it's like, oh, I ordered $25,000 worth of Pokemon, $20,000 worth of Pokemon. Where are all those people that were clamoring for this Pokemon product like 3 months ago when I ordered this? Now nobody's to be found. Well, shoot, I'd order this 3 months. And that's another thing too, is just like order windows. Magic is relatively close. Like, I still have like a week or two to finish ordering my Thunder Junction stuff if I wanted to. And I think that releases
May?
I think it's April.
Yikes.
Yeah. Because Wizards also is releasing a product a month, which is a lot.
My wallet knows.
Yep. but so like having that shorter window means like I can kind of play a little closer to the chest of just like, hey, if I need to adjust for the market, I can. But like One Piece, Bandai, like, we ordered sets 6 months from now with the hope of, hey, if this dies, hopefully we didn't order too much.
Yeah. So I have one more question for you. Let's bring it back to the world of miniatures here.
Yeah.
But also on topic we're discussing right now, what was like the biggest like oof that you like invested into in terms of a miniature war game or like just miniatures that like just... it didn't have, you know, the local interest to really support the amount that you ordered.
Guild Ball. I saw them clearance shelves.
Yeah. I'm trying to think. There's been a number of things, and it's not to say that the games are bad necessarily.
No, not at all. And it's also, it's a local thing as well, right?
Yeah. Like, the weird model stuff, Malifaux died out. For our local community, like, a friend of ours, David, was the henchman for that locally.
Yeah.
And, like, he was buckling down, and him and Michelle were having a kid and stuff like that. So he kind of backed away from that before third edition hit. And just, like, he honestly was the lifeblood of that local community. And suddenly...
imploded.
And not that it's his fault that it didn't work for us, but it was, like, a mix of, like, that and then them not giving any real information before third edition. Suddenly, like, interest really waned in this product, and then suddenly it was just like, oh, yeah, we're just not going to order that anymore.
Okay. So Weird was kind of...
Malifaux.
Yeah, Malifaux was a big one.
We see that a lot.
Conquest was another one.
Conquest.
Yeah.
Okay. The redo of Conquest, is this OG Conquest?
It was OG Conquest. So, like, I keep hearing good things now, but
I bought so many of those models. They had so many at the old source. Yeah. It was like, they had a whole wall like as big as the Games Workshop section.
Wait, what are you buying?
Conquest. Or not Conquest.
I'm thinking of Rackham.
Confrontation.
Confrontation, yeah.
That game just imploded Conquest? On itself.
Yeah, that was itself.
That was the whole thing.
Conquest. Argument of Kings.
Yeah, it's Last Argument of Kings. Parabellum.
Yep.
God. It's a long name.
I don't know anyone that's ever played that game.
There's a group that does demos at Game Center on Saturdays.
Yeah.
That's all I know of.
I was talking to, at Gen Con, I was talking to Jamie Daggers about it because she painted a model from that for the paint contest. And I'm like, do y'all have like a big community for that around you? Because I think they're also Midwest based somewhere. And so she was just like, yeah, like we have a pretty decent community for it. The game seems really fun. I'm like, I know like two people that have played that game. Like Dave and Michelle were buying that game, and we were literally like basically trying to give it to them for our employee discount to get the rest of it off of our shelf. It just like for us, for some reason, whatever reason, it just, there is not a community in our area. We also, the other thing too, that doesn't help some of that stuff is there's like 30 something game stores in the cities. Like this is like a hobby mecca. Yeah. It's a lot. But so like some of that stuff becomes localized to specific areas.
True.
Like our Middle Earth group is kind of an oddity. Like
our song group is
an oddity. And like I know there's other pockets of it throughout the cities, but there's a lot of stores that are just like, yeah, we don't deal with that whatsoever. There's a lot of stores that don't do miniatures at all.
Yeah.
I think, though, that that's a testament of a successful store is you recognize that, you facilitate that growth, and you make sure that that's, that those customers can rely on you to get those products that they want because that's what your local area wants. And yet that could be the case that, you know, 3 miles down the road, Conquest is huge, and that store is making money off Conquest. If they're identifying that and you're investing, like, there's real dollars, investing tens of thousands of dollars as a store into getting the product for Middle Earth because that's what your people want. And I think that's such a big thing, that what the difference that I see in the frustrations I've had with local stores is, like, not identifying and more importantly, not supporting, which leads to my last question for you, Dan, which is, in your ideal world, what role does the game store play in supporting your game community for playing the games? And to clarify that a little bit, do you think that you should have employees that are the standard bearers for each of the local games, and they ensure those games get on your store calendar? They ensure the community knows about this. Or do you think that you need to identify, cultivate, and support local players that aren't employees to do that, and you act as the best way to help them succeed? You think one or the other is better? Or
I think a mix of both is necessary. Because even with, like, for us having, like, almost 30 employees, like, not everything can be covered by employees.
Sure.
Like, I look at what we do for our events calendar, now doing all the event stuff. Like, I look at each day of the week, how many different things we have going, and it's, like, not physically possible for all. And also the interests of your employees, too. Like, with us being, the big thing is we are split straight down the middle, games, comics.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of people that are interested in comics and don't really have any interest in, like, board games or especially miniatures games. That's still a little bit of a narrow focus for our staff versus, like big event days, like Free Comic Book Day, that kind of stuff.
Yep.
Everybody reads at least some sort of book, that kind of thing. Like, it doesn't always cross over both ways. So, like, having a mix of employees and customers, because I keep referencing the Lord of the Rings stuff, like, I would love to play more of that game. I have an army for it. It's at the store in that local creator display case. So if the organizer is running demos of it, like, hey, you need an extra army here, I'll pull it out of the case. You can use it. But, like, I would love to play the game more. I just don't have enough hours in the day to do all the stuff I would like to do as far as organized play. Like,
But you help them succeed.
But I help them succeed.
Right.
Do you, like, think the company should empower individuals to, like, raise it up in their local meta?
Yeah.
Like,
okay. So, like, I think the company should be doing stuff to also help facilitate that. Like, I look at what Jason's doing with, like, Monument Hobbies. They just did a thing where they're doing support for stores as well to be able to pass that stuff along to those people that may organize that stuff, like that kind of stuff. GW, as much as sometimes I'll gripe about GW, like, they have, like, credit that they give to stores. It's not a crazy amount for how many different, like, events we kind of run throughout a year, how many events we support throughout a year, but it helps kind of offset that at least a little bit as far as compensation, where with that program, I can basically talk to my rep and be like, hey, I have a tournament coming up. Can I put in an order that's comped, that's these things? Downside is it's like they only do it off of the MSRP price, so it doesn't go anywhere near as far. It's still
it's still some product that
and it's based on how much you order.
Sure. Okay.
But yeah,
but it's something.
Yeah,
they're doing something.
Yeah. I think it's important. Like, you just described Malifaux, how it died the moment that David decided he wasn't going to, you know, support it anymore. It's like, dude, people like David are incredibly important for, like, the purchasing of your product at a local game store. That's given me some interesting perspective.
Oh, yeah. Like, I literally was just talking about this yesterday with a coworker, how the guy that organizes the Lord of the Rings for us, Russ, like, nicest dude, but also he's organizing that one thing, but also going through that effort, ordering the, like, web store exclusive stuff, brings in that community, and then, like, now, like, a couple of the other people in the group, like, one of them is really big into historicals, so he's going over and buying a bunch of the Victrix models. Even, like, certain Lord of the Rings things aren't available, some of the Lord of the Rings players will go over there and buy some of the historical stuff that is historically a pun intended, much slower moving product, like that helps that sell. Or like
it's hobby disease.
Yeah. One of those other people in that group is a huge board gamer. So he's literally coming in itching every week for like, what's the new release? What did Asmodee put out this week? What's that new board game? What's that about?
Yeah, man.
But like he wasn't coming in as frequently until like that Lord of the Rings group kind of started up. And then Russ himself will do a little, I give him a ton of crap because he does a little bit. So like Fallout is a big thing for him. Mm-hmm. So like the Fallout Magic set, I'm like, you want a case of decks? You want to buy a case of decks? Did you look at the playmats? They have a VATS playmat that looks real cool. I'm buying one. You should buy one. But so like I get to be a bad influence for that. And then like he did stuff like now this last year, he branched out and did, it was either one of the Star Wars RPGs or is the Fallout RPG by Modiphius. He ran a game of that for Free RPG Day and he bought like the skirmish game models when we still had those. Mm. Speaking of another game that just didn't work as well selling through the store, the Fallout skirmish game made me a little sad that it wasn't as big, but it sounds like they're revamping that, so I'm curious about that. But yeah, like basically someone like him is diversifying into other things, but then also like advocating for those other parts of the hobby to other people as well, and really that's growing your community. And like as much as I'd love for it to be largely employees, like those people, like you just can't cover all your bases on your own with that. And especially for smaller stores where like my hometown store, I think the owner only has like 4 employees at the Fondy store, like maybe 3 or 4 employees at the Fondy store, so not a ton of people. So like he can't do all that. He has to rely on like local community members for some of that stuff and to advocate for that because they just don't have the staff for it.
Yeah, I find that's the way that it works, is that the smaller the store, like you have less resources in terms of your staff, that the amount of bases you can cover to be passionate about. And I typically find that most local smaller stores, they just start up around their main driver is the one big thing that's passionate for the owner. Oftentimes that's magic.
Yep.
Right. And so that guy will make sure that he'll do his damnedest to have all the product in for Magic on time. And he'll have a wide variety of sets, or he'll do a lot of singles and that kind of thing, because that's the thing he cares about. And once you get further and further removed, unless you're in an actual like Games Workshop store, it's harder to, you know, juggle all those plates to support a community. So I'm with you there. It's like, how do I'm not the expert. You're showing a lot of passion. You're an expert. How can I as a store help you succeed and help more people get into this game? Because that means they're spending more time here. They're spending more money here. They find other people to play with. It's a win-win.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a tough thing, though, I find that, especially as a small business owner. There's like, they got to be overwhelmed.
Yeah.
How can they manage all of that? Well, shoot, you can't.
The other thing, too, is like you were mentioning how like a store owner that started a store basically based off of Magic, diversifying too into those other things with passionate community members also means your store is going to have more of a safety net in Wizards, Tanks, Magic tomorrow. Hey, we have other stuff that makes us money.
Yep.
Like right now, the comic side of stuff is not great. Like I keep seeing stores in local groups and national groups talking about like, hey, are other stores doing this thing where we're just not ordering new comics because they're just not selling well enough for us, or like the shipping costs aren't covered by like what we make in profit from selling that. Like, so like new comics are really struggling right now. But for us, it's something that we don't necessarily hardly notice because we have money coming in from so many other different directions that it's fine.
And it's diversifying, you know. That's it. Because one thing I'm taking away from this conversation, which is not a bad thing, it's a reality of the situation, is a lot of this stuff are being savvy in business.
Yeah.
Right? It's a thing that you're passionate about. It's a passion-based business, which most small businesses are. But if you're not really tight on that, the business financial side of it, you're going to get yourself in trouble real
quick.
Same
is true for YouTube, right?
Yeah.
You can't just be a passionate filmmaker or in whatever the thing is you do in front of the camera, right? You also have to know how to conduct your business, at least to last long term.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. If you want to keep doing it, and often that's your motivation, you got to be able to hit the other side of it, the stuff that's not so fun.
You got to balance your checkbook, you know? You got to do that bullshit.
Yeah.
Another thing I was going to kind of backtrack a little bit to as well with like those community members and those volunteers, make sure you take care of those people too. Mm-hmm. So like some of that GW credit went towards like for the Middle Earth stuff. Like Russ was coming in for the first like couple, like first number of months with his own terrain and stuff like that, that he was painting up, etc. The Asgiliath box came out and I'm like, hey, can we get one or two of those comped? And we broke one apart for tournament prize support. People won different parts of it for models and stuff like that. And I took the terrain and I basically went up to Russ and I'm like, here.
Mm.
Like, awesome. You've been given your own terrain to the store basically to use. Like, he literally, I keep joking that we need to get lockers at the store for him. he shows up every week with like two to four big flat totes of terrain that he has painted that he has bought mostly from the store. But like, that's where I'm just like, hey, like, you've bought a ton of this yourself. Like, let us help you like make your own collection nice, because we know you're going to be a super generous person with your time and your effort and your money towards others. Mm-hmm. Like the amount of times I've walked back there and seen him give a model to someone just like, hey, yeah, I have an extra of this. Here you go.
Yeah.
Schaefer's kind of the same way, where like anyone getting into Necromunda, like
he's your guy
where like, yeah, he'll let you borrow stuff to learn, he'll show up with terrain for you to learn with and it'll be gorgeous and amazing and it's immersive, and then it kind of helps people grow where just like, I want to do that as well. And those sorts of people are priceless. And just the big part of that is just make sure you take care of those people as well,
right?
Like, I know we give store credit for game time for certain events, things like that. Tournament organizers, like, we make sure they're taken care of. Like, if artists come in to do signings for comic books and stuff, I make sure, like, hey, do you need something to drink? Do you need something to eat? Like, yes, you're selling some of your own merchandise, but also, like, you're advocating stuff for the store. Like, yeah, we might order heavier knowing that you're coming in for that, but... like, you're still bringing people into the store specifically for you. Or, like, with us being such a large platform, it also means, like, smaller artists, then big artists will also help out smaller artists, because that means, hey, those big artists, yeah, they may bring people in. Those smaller artists may not. We can then kind of pay it forward by basically being like, hey, we're going to put you on free comic book day. We have, what, 2,000 to 4,000 people come through the store. I have a bunch of artists in the back. It's a mix of like, hey, you're a big name, but this person may not be yet. Mm. They're just getting started. This is their first time doing any sort of an event for their book. Hey, we know that now this person is going to be put in front of 4,000 people. Mm. And it's kind of like a nice pay it forward thing, that it's like one of those names will bring people in, but then also that starts people coming in. We can put them in front of people that might not have their name known to. Okay. But yeah, it's kind of like taking care of your community, and your community takes care of you.
Maybe that's one of the reasons why the sources lasted so long. The question you asked is that you are heavily invested in your community, and then that is repaid back to the source. The people represent value to your store, so it makes sense. Why wouldn't you do that? Well, Dan, thank you for giving us an insight into the world of managing a large game store, like 10,000 square foot, you said, 30 employees approximately. That's incredible. I appreciate your time. We're going to get into the after party now, though.
Yeah, and then we'll be back for the end of the podcast.
Welcome to the end of the podcast. We just had an amazing time in the after party, taking our shirts off and just running around greased up. It was great.
Yeah, that was it. We put a duck in the studio.
Yeah,
we let it free, and then we had to chase it.
We had a camera following us.
Yeah. The camera was a GoPro, a little baby GoPro on the duck's head.
So yeah, so it could see us constantly trying to dive for it. And then we went and took a shower because obviously we were greasy.
Yeah. Duck POV, and then the duck
duck POV
just sat in the bathtub afterwards.
Yeah.
Yeah. We gave the duck the bath afterwards.
Yeah.
So
it's
you missed
time,
it.
Actually.
You missed it. You know, you're not a patron. You missed it.
Yeah.
Disappointing.
Yeah. Thank you, Dan, for hanging out with us today and letting us know the inner workings of working in a game store. Is there any, let's say people wanted to see your weird lizards with hats. Do you post that kind of stuff on the internet anywhere? Could you share where people can find you?
Sure. Pretty much everything. I use the same handle, except for Twitch. I'm still fighting to get Danimals on Twitch. I use the tag at Dan E Malls because my name literally spells that, and it's easier to get than Danimals with an I. So Danimals with an E. And yeah, I usually post more of that stuff on Instagram. I've been really bad about posting lately, and I keep meaning to post like our Necromunda stuff, and I keep taking pictures during games and then not posting them outside of our group chat.
Well, the thing is, you got a little bit of a runway between when we're recording this now until where this goes live, so then when people see this and then they follow you, then they'll see it all. So no pressure, but you better get that shit up there right now.
No pressure.
Now I'm on a clock.
Yeah, now you're
on a gang painted.
You're on like a week and a half on clock.
Yeah, yes. Exactly.
And then also, if any goody peepees are attending Adepticon, Dan will be there, so we'll see him with us probably oftentimes as well. So stop and say hi. Ask him how many rocks he's carrying in his pocket. If you have a special shiny rock, Dan will always appreciate those.
That's very true.
I think on Twitch you're like at somewhere in like the higher 300s now with the number of rocks in your pockets. It's probably the best Twitch command I have in my channel is how many rocks does Dan have in his pocket, and then whenever you type Danimals, it just goes up by one.
I love it.
It's a lot of rocks.
You know that's a contract that you now have to give me that many neat rocks.
Like, hey, I have some neat rocks here.
Yeah, I know. You have neat rocks at your house too.
Amber's got a lot of neat rocks.
I'd make Amber real sad if I just waddled out of the
house.
You
can take some. Honestly, there are too many. We do not have the display capacity for all of them. But if you guys enjoy the podcast and you want to support it, as we discussed earlier, Patreon is a great way. There's also Teespring down in the description that has a lot of awesome merch that we make. We have three different designs that go on pants, shirts, sweaters, all kinds of stuff. I actually had an email recently that someone was like, my Tup sweater has lasted many loads of laundry. And I was like, wonderful.
Great.
It's so comfy. Mine hasn't shrunk on me yet.
Oh, amazing.
Thank God.
Wow. Oh, yeah.
Half my shirts keep shrinking lately, so I have to stop drawing my shirts.
Yeah, I did that all my shirts too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so comfy.
If you want to support the podcast in a free way, you can tell other people about the podcast, sharing the good word, giving us a review on wherever you're listening to podcast episodes. You can also whitelist our YouTube channel. We play an ad every 30 minutes. And those are the ways you can do it if you don't want to spend any actual dosh. Otherwise, roll us out.
Yeah. The next time you see us, it'll either be at Adepticon, where you will be attending the live recording of Tup at Adepticon, or you'll catch us here in a fortnight for that episode as it'll be released. We're recording that, and you'll see what it was like live at Adepticon. But until then, we will catch you on the
Flippity Flop.